And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. Merry Christmas. Frohe Weihnachten for those in the Germanosphere. I know that they celebrate it today. And tomorrow, of course, for everyone else, Merry Christmas. I'm now here with probably the most hotly anticipated guest each year, Morgoth of Morgoth's Review. Hardly needs any introduction, so we won't bother with that. I'll just go straight into it and say, Morgoth, welcome back to the show. Thank you for doing this.
Welcome back. Thank you. I mean, I can say Merry Christmas this year because normally I'm at the end, but...
Yeah. It's a novelty. It's quite strange for me as well.
One thing on the other, I just got in the way, and it was just you can't. It's nice to have the same spot every year, but like there's just things getting away. I'm going to be doing things and going away and all that. So you know, I'll do it next year.
Okay, thank you. So obviously this year. Was punctuated for you with one quite singular event. Do you want to talk about that first?
Yeah, we can get into it. The Hope Not Hate, sort of the docks, the surveillance operation. The only it's kind of strange because it's as if it just completely didn't matter at all. I just carried on afterwards, but it was quite nerve wracking at the time. But looking back now, I was like, well, it just didn't seem to matter. Nobody seems to care. And I haven't really touched on it very much either. I did one blog post and that was it. And then we just went back to normal. And then that was the end of it. But it was quite of a thing. It was strange because I've been looking at what's going on today with these, the Trump administration's like banned a few bureaucrats and sort of the censors from Europe, you know, the what they call the censorship industrial regime. And I was having a look and I saw that Carol Cadwalla she's done like a quickie sort of response to this because she's wrapped up in it and she's done an article on Substack and that like this kind of ties back to the Hope Not Hate stuff, which we can get into in that. And her Substack here says, the so-called global censorship industrial complex is a tiny world of academics and NGOs and journalists and policy wonks and lawmakers and disinformation researchers who for the last decade have been trying to understand the power and reach of the tech platforms, how they are visibly controlling and manipulating our information spaces. And the general tenor of her piece is that the people who are being attacked by the Trump administration, they're just a bunch of nerds. They're just a bunch of researchers and a bunch of kooky nerds who go down into the engine room
and innocently exploring to try to understand
these new trends. And it's like, no, you're a lying cunt. That's not what you do. You censor people and you destroy people's lives. And this is the same with all of them. And it's this kind of, this sort of barefaced lie that's not what you are. And this is why it ties back to Hope Not Hate, because now also in The Guardian, like you've got to kind of suck it up that they're this like prestigious organization when they're not. They're this like really scummy, dodgy, shady bunch of midwits, basically.
Yeah, yes.
And so they got my photo from this is amazing. They got my photo from a conference that I went to in 2023. Now, the thing is, I didn't really care much about the, obviously I went to the conference, so it was like, you take that, you can get docs, you don't care what, you know, if your name and your face is out there. So I was like, all right, whatever. If it happens, it happens. I'm just a bloke with a blog at the end of the day. And so the Harry Shukman faked his way, got in, took my photo, and then that was it. And it wasn't like 18 months later, they kind of got a surveillance operation on me. And the funny thing is that the actual conference that I went to, my subject that I went along to give a little speech on, was actually about digital surveillance. Because I've been screaming about this for years. It's one of my kind of go-to things that I do videos on and write about for years, is digital surveillance and the sort of the control grid and all of that. And here's me going along. Like, that was my subject that they've... So then they've got my photo and they do exactly what I was expressing, sort of worried about in the speech, is what they do then. Because somehow, this is the problem, because I've got to be careful because I'm not entirely sure. So I've got theories, but it looks like they've got some kind of back door into the Home Office. And then they can feed a photo into the system and it'll come up with a range of passports. So basically, if you take somebody's photo and then you've got access to certain parts of the Home Office, then you could, what will come up is that a picture on a passport to match the photo that you've got. So that's how because I was thinking, why did they go to that old address? If they've got all of this information on me, but they went to a place where I hadn't lived for like quite some time, which I thought was really odd. And then I think that's why. It's because that's where I happened to be living when I actually last got a passport. And so you go along to this sort of, you go along and you give a speech about how you're concerned about digital technology, and then you've got the worst people in the world sort of with these kind of what appears to be, but I can't prove, shady, sinister carve-outs with the government on government funds, and you kind of mislabel yourself as being called a charity. And then on top of that, you offer people compensation. You put notes through people's letterboxes and offer
bribes.
Well, I've got to say compensation because that's what's on the letter itself. And you're always walking in eggshells. You're walking on eggshells because you don't know what the lead is.
All right, I get it. So I shouldn't have said bribes. That's outrageous. They would compensate people for giving information about you.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, all of it was very shady and very sinister. And then they went door to door, up and down the street, asking questions about me to everybody. And the funny thing is, why it was a bit weird was because in the hit piece they said I was
reclusive, wasn't it?
Reclusive, but. I'm actually not reclusive at all. Like, I'm always out and about. I was always out and about when I lived there as well. And in fact, the people that I was getting contacted and asked by me neighbours, who I still have contact with because I like them and I used to speak to everybody, and they were like, there's just been two lads, what looked like two young puffs, were knocking on the door, like asking questions about you in a YouTube channel. Like, what's all that about? And then it was like I realized they were on my trail, you know.
Well, and I think it actually is too young. I think they are gay because I think it was Harry Shukman and Patrick Hermanson.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
the instincts of the Geordie.
And it's like that Shukman one as well. It's like if you look into his background, Well, he's not ethnically English, I'll put it that way, but I think he's even connected to like the Rothschilds family or something like that.
And it's so astonishing. Yeah. It's so steady.
And then the contrast of that is that they arrive on this sort of post-industrial area of North Tyneside, where I lived. So you've got like these super privileged people literally going door to door on this kind of working class sort of rural flats. Because one of them got uppity, because one of them decided that he was getting a bit sick and tired of the nonsense and the lies. So we're going to have to go along and flex on him and surprise him. Hopefully he'll be in his pajamas and have a gormless look on his face, and we can get that as the picture and all of that. You know all about that trick. And it's like, it's time that we have to, and they're going to pretend that this kind of grassroots organization and all of it just makes you absolutely sick. On the Home Office thing, though, remember there's also another story out there where he got a fake passport and gallivanted across Europe. So these are the great defenders of like, you know, the underprivileged.
Well, apparently it was he actually changed his name by deed poll legally, so it was actually legal.
And then he changed it back again.
Yeah, after a year.
I know that's what they said. I don't believe it. I think they're liars. But whatever.
But this thing about these very privileged people attacking the working class and so on, I had a skim through that guy's book, Harry Shookman, and he talks about a guy briefly who I knew. He died earlier this year, and he was one of the best people I've ever known, and one of the most intelligent people I've ever known as well. And he came from the working class. He had a very humble background, Tooting in London, and born in the late 40s. And he didn't go to university, he didn't go to grammar school. He was entirely self-educated, and he was one of the most knowledgeable people you could ever meet. And he was self-made in some shady sectors at first, and then latterly not. And they've talked about that. But the point was that I thought the contrast between him and Harry Shookman was just astonishing, because Harry Shookman has come from wealth. He's had every privilege, every advantage that you could want, whereas my friend had none whatsoever, and had to do everything himself. And Harry Shookman was just mocking him in his book and denigrating him. And I find it so repulsive and disgusting that they would do this to, as I say, one of the best people I've ever known in my life. And he wasn't a public figure, you know, he was such a kind man, such a good man. And as far as I can tell, Harry Shookman is a piece of shit.
Yeah, and the aim is to absolutely destroy you. You can see in the article they did on me, where they basically accused me of inciting a terrorist thing. I mean, like 11 years ago as well, all of the stuff they dredged up was like stuff from 11 or 10 years ago, and even then it was out of context. There was nothing in like recently, even like 7 or 8 years ago, there was just nothing. But the point is, of course, they don't care. The aim is to just destroy my life so, you know, I could never get a place to rent. I would never get a job again, or all of this, because that now comes up with my name. Is that I'm a far-right extremist and I incited a terrorist attack in America. Like, and there's nothing I can do.
It's completely untrue.
None of that is true in any way. And there's not much you can do about it. And this is now you kind of get this sort of disillusionment. And I think this is why it's interesting to sort of kick off with this subject, because you look at the Carol Cadwalla's piece there, and they're just numb. They're just numb to how repellent these people are. They've got no self-awareness. They don't think maybe like they are the problem. And we reached a point in 2025, I think, where it's like the whole world is screaming at these people, particularly the ones in the United Kingdom and in the European Union, because the ones in America have been defeated. And now it's like the whole world is screaming at them, like, please, why don't you people just fuck off? Like, please yeah. just fuck off.
Yeah, I think nobody is interested. And this is what's been fascinating to see. One of the things that's been fascinating to see over the last year, I guess it's been happening for about maybe since after COVID, not during COVID, but I think COVID was the, you know, you and I worried so much about COVID at the time, but I think actually it was when the public had their fill of this bullshit. They had that was the peak of it. And then Ukraine was a sort of on the residual fuel of that. But then they were exhausted. And then the Boris wave starts to bear fruit. And, you know, in Britain, similar things in other countries. And this exhausted and discredited the left. And now, when an organization like Hope Not Hate operate and speak, I mean, I dare say they've still got a lot of credibility with the establishment, with the system. But I think with the public at large, I mean, the public at large are dealing with rapes in their town by migrants, by refugees, asylum seekers, or they've heard about it happening in a nearby town. If it hasn't happened in their town, it's happened bloody close to their children. So when Hope Not Hate come around and tell them about some bad guy, or tell them how they should feel or what they should think, I think they're probably getting a much colder reception than they would have, say, in 2018.
And these bad things that have been happening are happening because of their values. Me or you are not responsible for little girls getting butchered at a dance concert. And there's a tendency, like, what I'd like to see is where there's this tendency where they immediately, people on our side will immediately blame the immigrant themselves. And I understand it. It shouldn't be that. I get it. But ultimately, what I think would start and scare people, and I've started to do this, is say, actually, it's Hope Not Hate are responsible for these people being murdered and raped, actually, and the rest of the system. Like, it's on you. These are your values. You fought this. You fought for this to happen. You know, the story this year where there was somebody in Epping, I thought it was fascinating that the people in Epping made it loud and clear that they did not want to have all of these migrants staying in that hotel. And they got it forced on them anyway. And it was then, after you got, there was like a young girl was sexually assaulted, and then it was covered up by the media. So then they took to the streets to protest again to say, well, you know, we were right, you know. And then they launched an appeal. Then it was said that we're going to shut it down. And then I think it was like the Supreme Court, which is another Blairite bunch of bullshit. They came and said, well, actually, no, well, it's going to stay open. And it's like they did everything they could to say, we don't want this. They were then vindicated. They were proven correct that they had, like, the suspicions they had in the first place were then confirmed because there was at least one assault. I think there might be more. And then despite the fact that it was confirmed that they were correct, they were still brushed aside. This, and again, it's just like we know that it's just lies. And I think when you see this every day, day in, day out, I don't see how you can have a system which maintains legitimacy for very long at all. And you think, where the hell is all this going? You know, when it's obvious that the people at Epping or me or you, just normal people at the end of the day. I'm long past the time where you would kind of, I'm a far right edge. I'm just a normal bloke. And we are the ones who are being vindicated every single day. And all of this vermin that occupy all of these institutions, it has to be like hung on them. And I think it increasingly is. And I don't know. Like I'll put it this way. Like, I wouldn't want to be them for much longer, to be honest. Which is part of the sort of discussion that we've had this year, is that kind of thinking, that kind of talk coming out, which you've got to be very careful about, of course.
Of course. But at the same time, it's just a self-evident truth. And I think a lot of people are, and this is what I mean, I Hope Not Hate must be getting when they do these educational programs. I mean, the educational system is still drunk on this stuff. Everyone is saying this. The schools are still as lefty as ever and all the rest of it. But ordinary people, and not just the working class anymore, I think increasingly the middle class as well, are, I think, very aware that this has all been a mirage and a trick, or at best an experiment that didn't work out. It has not worked out. And now we are all in danger. And, you know, this is all, this was obvious to me when I started in 2014. This is what it was always about. I can say categorically, it was never about hating immigrants or hating non-white people and demonizing them. It came in my case, and I'm sure in your case as well, it came from a love for my own people, and I perceived that they were in danger, and there were very serious issues to discuss and talk about, that laid the ground for all of that. And so I started talking, and so did you. And I think, I mean, if you oppose that, you're really against open, you're simply against dialogue, you're simply against discussion. And I think this is the position that they've been in for some time, that they're really just, they're not the reasonable, rational ones. They're not the open-minded ones, even. They are the censors and controllers. And it's not a virtuous position to be in. It's actually a sick position to be in. And again, the results of all this, the results of my forebodings 11 years ago and yours, are now materializing. And so I don't, if Hope Not Hate and their ilk had any decency, at this point they would give in and say, you know, you were right, and we can only apologize. And I don't think that's going to happen in a million years. I think they'll hold on to the bitter end. But it must. I do think that at some level, it sometimes occurs to them, these are just ordinary people.
Yeah,
we are attacking ordinary people, and we're going to keep doing it. But holy shit, it's kind of weird that we're just attacking ordinary people, isn't it? Weird business we're in.
And I think there's a kind of cognitive dissonance, which a lot of the, I've noticed some funny things going on the left this year. But in the case of Hope Not Hate in particular, because of let's say their identities, I don't think there's a limit. I don't like what we have now, where it's like the daily rape. On the daily rape for an English girl gets raped or assaulted by asylum seekers. And it's like this new thing. There was two today were from Syria. That was in the Daily Mail today. And then on an 18-year-old girl. And you'd think, like, how many is it going to take? Like, is it 5,000? Is it every English girl? Is it every single girl in England who's white has to be raped by an immigrant? Will you reconsider your sort of stance then, or what? Well, what's the deal here? When is the last drop? When is the cup of misery full enough? And it fundamentally, the people who talk about hate, it isn't. There is an infinite amount of suffering and pain can be inflicted on our people be by them. But then when you look at somebody like Carol Cadwalla or these, they're the same group as us. And I did a video earlier this year where I said how Boris, the Boris wave rubbed the left's face in diversity. And what I was getting at was because if you're in like the British scene, that you everybody's heard that trope from, I think it was Andrew Neither, about the left in the Blair years, where the Blair's government were going to rub. And we've all heard of that before.
Yeah, and I actually sought out the original article this year. I found it, and I'd never seen it. I'd never read the whole thing before. It's quite interesting. Sorry.
Yeah, and there was a. I think something's happened where the Boris wave was so crazy that it kind of flipped the script. And what happened was that the Boris wave rubbed the left's face in diversity, because now they were having to live up to their ideals, which for still a hell of a lot of people in the country were sort of abstract. And they were kind of theoretical positions, not lived realities. So especially, you know, during the 2000s, I mean, most of the migrants that were coming in were from the European Union, so they were white. And it was, but their ideals, they extend to all humanity. But there wasn't yet, we hadn't yet arrived at a position where there were Syrians and Afghanis and Somalias in every town and village in England. And so they could kind of retreat into this sort of, this idea that it would work in theory. But then when it's actually arrived in the flesh, in the material realm, and it's just a never-ending parade of rape and vape shops and squalor, and it's low status and completely alienating, I think that they struggle to find a frame on that. I think it's kind of winded them a little bit, because it's like, yeah, I don't like this either. And we see this these copes now where this year everybody's sort of saying how safe and how wonderful London is, and everybody knows it's shit. Everybody knows, like, they don't feel safe on the streets anymore. Everybody sees the daily rape atrocity, and it's kind of breaking the left in a way in the country. It's kind of like disorientating them and wearing them down, you know?
Yeah. And I wrote something similar in one of my essays this year, that the multiculturalism, diversity, these were buzzwords of the 2000s. I mean, the multiculturalism, I think that term was first coined in the 70s, but I'm not sure. It might be in the 60s. But it was first sort of inaugurated in 1981 with the Scarman report into the Brixton riots, as far as I know. And then it became a thing, and it was really a buzzword in the 2000s, and late 90s and 2000s. And we were meant to, it was kind of new to ordinary people. It was a new concept, and same with diversity. And they sort of gleamed with newness. And but now, for ordinary people, those words are have a completely different tinge. It's what it means for ordinary people now is, as you said, grot, squalor, vape shops, Turkish barbers, and just general shittiness, and lots of rape. I mean, I it sounds like I'm exaggerating, but I don't think I am. I think for a lot of ordinary people now, what multiculturalism ultimately means is white girls getting raped. That's the sort of visceral, the most visceral reaction that they have to. That's the most base interpretation that it creates in their minds, is it means that our kids get raped. And you know, it obviously doesn't mean that all the time, but it's becoming a very common feature of everyday life in Britain. And if you could have shown this to our ancestors, the sheer number of rapes going on, sexual assaults, and so on, of mostly females, but also boys as well, by migrants. Our ancestors would have been absolutely incensed by this. And this is why it's such a joke to say that, well, the British people voted for this, that they wanted this. They absolutely didn't. And they didn't even know the full reality of it. I don't think they even knew a tenth of how bad it would be. I really don't. If you'd like our ancestors in the 50s, I don't think they would even have assumed that, you know, there'd be a migrant raping a white girl once a month, let alone pretty much every single day. And even then, they were outraged by the idea of mass immigration. And that's, I think it's very important to remember this and to try to conceive of this, you know, just how much our ancestors would find this current situation that we are living in outrageous, intolerable, and utterly unacceptable, and simply not the Britain that they knew.
And almost everybody, because you kind of get the sense that, well, is it just because like we're on social media and we're scrolling Twitter? And it's really not. Everybody I speak to in the real world is kind of lurching far, far to the right. In fact, I often find myself being this kind of older sort of, because there's a complicated thing in how you deal with your sort of private life and your family and your friends. And it used to be really difficult. I remember about 10 years ago, there was a family do, and I got a bit pissed, and I was kind of going on about why they were all normies, and it was really frustrating us. And it was awful. It was a really awkward thing because I was getting so frustrated that the people me nearest and dearest just didn't seem to care about the change in demographics in the country. And now when I'm in similar situations, I tend to be the one that says the least. And I'll maybe give the conversation a little nip and a little tuck somewhere, but it's always them who are going off on it now. I mean, everybody's racist. Everybody's racist now.
Everyone's the racist uncle at Christmas.
Everybody's racist. I was talking the other day, because one of the things, that it gets back to the sort of the hope not hate kind of thing with my neighbours, because what I used to do was kind of, when I got wise to it, I'd be very careful about how I said things and kind of sprinkle little red pills into things and stuff just to see the reaction. It's the same at work, you know, where you want to know, people need to know it's safe to say it and that kind of thing. And I was talking to this farm lad the other day, because I'm actually going to go out on the drink over Newcastle with a couple of my old mates, even though we're all like old farts now. It's for old time's sake, you know what I mean? We're going to go out. Those of us who are still alive. And we're going to go out. And I was talking to this farm lad, and he's saying, what you got planned for Christmas? I says, oh, we're going to get me old mates. We're going to have a night out in the town. I says, I think it's stupid. I'd rather be home. My slippers on at this age. And he says, ah, it'll be good. Good luck. I says, another thing, if I'm honest, I says, I don't want to get stabbed by an immigrant and end up as a video on X, while everybody's outraged about. And he burst out laughing. He says, well, it sadly has a good chance of that now, because I just swarm on the main everywhere. And he just totally, it was a cue where he was like given a green light to be racist. And he was just off to the races. And he got it all pouring out, you know what I mean? It never used to be like that. It never used to be like that. People would look at you as if to say, ah, they're not all like that, though, are they? Now it's just saturation point. Everybody's a racist.
Yeah. I mean, that's a word that I don't think that we should embrace, because it's playing into our enemy's hands. It should, because it's equivalent to saying, yeah, I'm evil. Yeah, I'm evil. I'll own it. From their point of view, that's how they'll use it. But the basic point that people are suspicious of foreigners and resentful of them in their country, I think is true. And you know, I don't have many normie friends. In fact, I don't have any normie friends nowadays, because they, you know, cut ties with me 10 years ago. But you sense it and you hear it. I mean, about 2-3 months ago, I got a taxi, and it's really strange. I don't get a taxi often. It's like once, twice a year, this event, and yet. The taxi driver, he said, I can't remember how he mentioned Sadiq Khan and said something like he's not working for the people or something like that. And I said, do you think things are heading in a bad direction in this country or something like that? And I said, do you think we're heading for civil war? Because this was when you know the David Betts thing was really at its peak. And this guy said, well, I think we're heading for something. And I mean, he wasn't shocked. He wasn't baffled at what I'd asked him. And it was him who'd brought up the subject. I hadn't. Because I wouldn't do that. I'm too timid to do that with a stranger. I wouldn't do that. But he brought it up. This is a taxi driver, like just a random guy. And what are the odds? I mean, if I were someone who got a taxi 100 times a year, then it wouldn't be so strange. But I think it's the only time this year that I got a taxi, and that's what the guy said. That's what the taxi driver said. And what are the odds of that? To me, that's significant. It implies this is on people's lips. This is the word on the street. This is the mood in everyday life. People are thinking this country is going to the dogs, and we are in his words, we're heading for something. He didn't say civil war, but trouble. That's what he meant. Upheaval. I think serious trouble.
I think one of the changes that's happened, which relates to the Boris wave, is that you've on the one hand you've got the sort of where it was an abstract ideal and now it's made real and it's just awful and horrifying. So there's that side to it, but there's another side to it where after a certain amount of like immigration into an area, which we see everywhere now, and you could even say that it splashes over into the media and social media on the adverts and stuff. But I think when it's one or two here or there, you're able to kind of individualize them. And so they're able to stand out and have a personality. I remember like one of the things you'll notice now is that nobody gives a shit where immigrants come from. But I remember back in the day, like my mate would be like back in, you know, 2001 or 2002, my mate would be like, oh, you can get Algerian shawarma now on the quayside, or it's so diverse and all of that kind of thing. Or you would say, oh, I was talking to this guy from Bangladesh. I tell you what, crazy country that, like, he's got some stories to tell. And I was like, right, okay. But now you never hear, nobody gives a shit where anybody comes from. It's just this kind of wall of otherness. It's just this sort of alienating biomass of unindividuated foreignness. It's awful, and nobody cares anymore about the individual's personal story or how he got here from Kurdistan or Iraq or wherever. Like you notice as well as a sort of this sort of generic brown, where it can be from Morocco up to kind of Mongolia or India, because you can kind of tell them ones apart, and it's just this like infinite brown. That and people now, even if you're a libtard, you'll be walking through like at some street in London or Birmingham or whatever, and that's what you're in amongst. And what will happen is when you see another white person, that's when you're kind of psychologically programmed to think there's one of mine. You're not thinking there's just another person in a sea of individuals. You're saying, well, that's another one of my people amongst all of this alien sort of swarm. And that kind of makes it impossible to actually hook proper personalities and individuate. What you're left with is kind of this alienating sense. And liberals will be like that as well. It fascinates me that like the Lib Dems are sort of probably like the more like the whitest party in the country. And that's essentially what they're doing. They're trying to create these shirelings where they can keep all of this out, but without being accused of being racists, without sort of catching the eye of the system. And somehow they managed to pull it off just. But this is what's really changed, is that you don't distinguish anymore between the foreigners.
Of course, because when it was just one guy or you know two of them each week, you could afford to. You could afford to be interested in their story and ask them about it, because it's a novelty. But when it's when it's 20 of them in a day in your town, then you're not going to the curiosity runs out very quickly, and as you say, it's just a biomass. And the interesting thing also, and yeah, you said that it's from. It covers a vast area of the globe where these people come from, and they basically all look the same. And the interesting thing is that diversity in, say, Birmingham looks pretty much exactly the same as diversity in Stockholm or Berlin or Bordeaux. You know, it actually destroys the identity of that place. Because now Berlin is just the same as Stockholm, and Berlin is just the same as Bordeaux, and they're the same as Birmingham. There's nothing really to choose between them. There's a lingering accent from the before time, but that's it. And yeah, you know, the architecture, but even that, yeah, you know, that can be demolished. So this is the actual result of diversity, is an utter lack of it. Because we're not interested in their individual stories, but meantime, they utterly drown out our individuality. So the result of it is just this awful, homogenous mass of human stuff. I mean, it's so grim.
It reminds me of a very old article that I wrote on Laura Trott. When she was winning I think this might be the first video that I ever did as well, where I was watching the Olympics. I can't remember which one now, but it was this kind of strange thing where it's just all of the third world. And then all of a sudden, like as one of your people pops up amongst this sort of kaleidoscope of the third world, biomass, you see like, one of your group, and your brain, and in this case, Laura Trott was like really, really pretty. She was doing the cycling, and she would pop up as they were giving out medals or whatever it was. And all of a sudden, you're kind of brought into the frame, and because you're programmed to notice your own type amongst all of the other stuff. And I think that's sort of what everybody's going to be going through now. And I think that's why there's so much of this kind of stampede towards the right that we're seeing all over the place. So some people will say it's all managed and all of that, or all that, it doesn't matter unless you change the elite. I think it does matter. I like to have my finger on the pulse and try to sort of figure out what the mind is of like, the country, like well, at least our part of it, our people. What is their mood? What are they thinking? You know, what is the state of being of this meme that we saw came out this year? The UK, which I find is so fascinating and so apt, like that UK aesthetics thing. Like, what is it that everybody thinks of that? You know, I'll go for a pint with a mate and I'll try and explain, and he'll get that straight away. And I like that. I like that kind of thing because it feels like things are starting to align once again after being kind of shattered. Like we're distinguishing ourselves. We're finding ourselves against this endless mass. And this puts the shitlibs in a terrible situation, I think, except for the fact they've still got the power.
Yeah, but things have definitely not gone as they thought they would. It's not gone their way. And in a way, it's unfortunate for them that they're still in power because it means that they have to deal with this. They have to deal with this reality, which they have created. I mean, we were talking earlier about hope, not hate. You could really say the same about virtually any politician because they were all on board. I mean, look at Robert Jenrick, who was completely on board with diversity and mass immigration, and now he has to pretend otherwise. Now, I mean, it's possible that he's had a change of heart, but I mean, for fuck's sake. It's a shame that it takes that much. But anyway, I don't really trust him an inch. I don't believe that he's had a change of heart. I think it's just, you know, expediency. But anyway, the point is, things have not gone as they expected. I think they expected that curiosity that one felt about that one random Lebanese immigrant that we met once a month, that curiosity would persist even when we're surrounded by them and engulfed by them. But of course it wouldn't. I mean, that is common sense tells you, of course it won't, because people will be, they're not threatened by that one Lebanese guy when it's only one, when it's only one a month or one a week. But they are existentially threatened when they're engulfed by foreigners, even if the foreigners aren't threatening them, even if the foreigners are being friendly to them. There's still that sense of, well, do they celebrate Christmas? What should I say? Should I wish them Merry Christmas? Or will that offend them? And even if they don't report me for being culturally insensitive, nonetheless, I still don't know whether they'll be amenable to the idea or not. They might well be offended. So even if they don't do anything to me, well, I don't want to offend them. So, I mean, this gets back to Robert Putnam's thing, that of course people are just going to withdraw, because what diversity actually does is destroy all social stability and cultural stability. It destroys people's ability to be calm and secure in everyday life. And so, again, it's not surprising that people are socializing much less than they did 20, 25 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I remember reading an article years ago about, it was on the alt-right website, I think, and it was they were talking about an aeroplane crash. Like, because this was when you were getting terrorist attacks going off all the time across Europe. And they were saying, like, if you apply that, if an aeroplane crashes into the side of a mountain, like, they go through it, it's the whole place is sectioned off, and you've got like 100,000 different widgets and gadgets and cogs and pieces of wiring, and they go through the whole thing, like, with just bit by bit, painstakingly sifting it apart till they can find out, like, what happened. What was the mechanism that failed? You know, what was it, a fuel line or the? Because there's so many different ways that an airplane can fail. But in actual fact, it's quite, well, for now, it's quite safe to fly on, to travel on an airplane, because they so painstakingly go through all of these safety procedures and safety measures. And the article kind of compared that to how we deal with sort of the safety and mass immigration and stuff. And you can see that they just don't do anything. If the, for example, if they applied that same scientific method to just say asylum seekers in hotels, to what they applied to aeroplanes, there would not be a single one of them people in the country. Not one. They would have to all be immediately deported. Why is it that you reduce the chances of dying in an airplane are reduced to one in the millions? But why is that not the criteria for keeping English girls safe from asylum seekers from Afghanistan or whatever? Like, why can't we apply that same methodology to keep our people safe? All that you can conclude is that the people in power don't really give a shit, or they're retards. It's the competence, incompetence, or malice thing again. And especially when they cover it up.
Yeah. And I wrote an essay this year, Incompetence or Malice, about that specific question, because it keeps coming up. Do they know, or are they just stupid and they don't know? In retrospect, it seems incredible that the British government, and this goes for all of the European governments, simply allowed vast numbers of people to arrive from other countries with completely different cultures without thinking, well, what's going to happen? How is this going to affect? How is their cult, that specific particular culture that we're thinking about allowing into the country, how will it react to British culture? And how will British culture react to it? And the thing is, I think it would actually have been quite almost impossible to really predict the way it's turned out. In the abstract, you would sort of look at cultural features and say, well, they're not directly contradictory, so I suppose they can coexist. The reality is, it's actually human nature above all. It's more than the culture, because it's human nature that just dictates that person's different from you. You can rape them. You can rape their daughter. That person's different from you. You can scam them. You can just try to get whatever resources you can out of them. That person is different from you, so you can requisition their old church building and turn it into a mosque. That person's different from you, et cetera, et cetera. And you can vandalize their property. You can graffiti their local area. You can do whatever. That person is different from you, so you don't need to be friendly to them. You can scowl at them. You can ignore them. You can speak in your own language around them so as to signal to them that newcomers have arrived. It's that simple thing. That person is different from you. And you know what's interesting is that it was never countenanced that racism would work the other way, in the other direction, that the newcomers would be racist to us. I remember 10 years ago when I was working in a bookshop, this old educational book from the 90s came in, and it was called Multiculturalism in Education or something like that. And I looked in the index for mentions of racism, and there was one mention, and I looked at that entry. I don't know what page it was on, but I looked at it, and it was entirely about white kids being racist to non-white kids. The possibility of the natives rejecting the newcomers or being cruel to them in whatever way. And I remember thinking, that was like 2013, 2012, I remember thinking, God, it's weird that they never thought it could go in the other direction. Well, the other night I made the mistake of listening to a new episode of the BBC's radio program, The Moral Maze, from this year, from like this month. And they're still doing that. They still have that mindset now. 30 years after that fucking book was published, the intelligentsia still assume that all racism comes from white people and goes toward and targets non-whites. They still can't conceive of the idea that, well, actually, the newcomers could be fucking shitty to us. I mean, it's not just in terms of raping us or killing us or whatever. It's microaggressions, whatever. I mean, a few years ago, I visited a friend on Christmas Day, And I got an Uber there and an Uber back. And along the way, I went to a Pakistani, an off license to get a bottle of wine from my friend. And so it was three different, you know, the Uber, the two Uber journeys, and then the Pakistani shop. And so that was three different brown people that I encountered on that Christmas day. And not one of them wished me Merry Christmas. Not one of them. And I consider that, a microaggression, let's say. I consider that deliberately, knowingly being fucking rude to their host group. Well, the BBC's Moral Maze and that book from the 90s never just doesn't enter their heads that this could happen. And it should have. And it should have occurred to our politicians 80 years ago. This is the kind of thing that could happen. And it would make everyday life crap for our people. But it never did.
And you see, this is why they've got a nightmare that now finally on these grooming gang inquiries, they're saying like we're gonna actually look towards the ethnic nature, the inter-ethnic nature of this. And I mean, I've been screaming about this for years that we're up to our eyeballs in like racism stuff, like incitement to racism or being racist or doing a hate speech or all of this other shite, and it never entered their heads at all that there could be an anti-white sort of racial animus behind the grooming gangs. Like, even though in the court reports, it's all there. All the racial slurs are there. But you've got to still pretend that they. This is one of those things. It's like you. It just wears you down. And I think it's like you've had that successful meme this year, and it is like that. Like, or the hatchling, you know, like. How can you sit on top of the Leveson inquiry, Stephen Lawrence, institutional racism? So you understand that crimes, we've totally tore the police apart and completely reconfigured the how justice system, the legal system in the country, how all of that works. And we've done that because we wanted to emphasize that crimes motivated by race or more serious, they'll get more heavier sentences. They're more morally wrong, all the rest of it. But you see that it's like one of those, it only goes one direction, because when you all of a sudden it's like, hang on a minute, what about the mass rape of white girls? And it's like, oh, well, that race doesn't have anything to do with it. Now, what's hang on a minute. What about all these laws? What about how hypersensitive we were? We've got like Stephen Lawrence there. Now when the victims are white, you've all become race-blind classic liberals. You only see individuals. And everybody knows it's a lie. Everybody can see straight through it. But you're left sort of stupefied. At the comprehension at they can't see that. How do they wire that together in their own minds? And it's the same as what I started with Carol Cadwallader. I'm sure in her mind she does think she's just like this cutesy little researcher who's in online trends and not part of the censorship industrial complex. They seem to have just convinced themselves of anything, which is sort of convenient truths.
Yeah, indeed. And there's a whole thing that could be said about that it just seems to be, I mean, there's this clip that just came out today about, actually, just before we get onto that, I want to pick up on something else you said, that when about interracial crimes, when it's white victims, suddenly race doesn't matter. And you'll see this on Twitter where someone will say, well, you only care about rape when it's brown men doing it. So you don't really care about the rape at all. You're just a racist. And my response to that, from I came up with this about a year ago, and it's what I say every single time, and I don't give them any more than this. I always reply, interracial crimes are worse. And that's, that's four words. And I like to think that beats them on their own terms. But, you know, I realize that in the real world, they don't actually care that much. But I like to show up the contradiction that, you keep telling us that interracial crimes are worse, that it's worse if race is involved. Well, then, here you go. This is why I care more when it's brown men raping white girls, because that denotes a racial animus, and it's a violation of the group. As much as it's a violation of that individual girl, it's a gesture of contempt and loathing towards her group. And this shouldn't be controversial. It's recognized implicitly whenever it's a white guy doing it to a non-white person. So it has to be recognized in the other direction. Now, obviously, if we were in charge, it absolutely would be. In the meantime, all we can do is say this. All we can do is point this out. But I think we should point it out relentlessly. And it's, as I say, it's four words. You don't need to go get into the weeds at all. Just say, interracial crimes are worse. And just leave it at that. Let them think about it.
Insisted upon that. They insisted upon that.
Yeah.
But then, it just exhausts you. It just this, and you think, where do these people come from? How can you be this?
I know.
This thick. How can you not? I've never met anybody in the real world who's like this. They would actually, they would say like, I see what you mean, mate. I suppose. Whereas these shit libs, there was one of them that I saw this year, and it inspired me to do like a whole quite long essay and a video essay. I turned it into a video as well. And it was some shit lib had posted a picture of Myra Hindley and said, British born and bred or whatever. And the assumption was like, you've got your own mass murderers and serial killers, so you can't complain about Axel Rudikabana. That was the general gist of it.
I mean, that's a retarded argument on its face, actually. Yeah. But then...
And I thought it was interesting because it took me on a kind of journey, on a kind of odyssey, because I realized that's the first time I've seen Myra Hindley's sort of mugshot, the famous mugshot with the peroxide. That's the first time I've seen that for years and years. And it's funny that it's why I mentioned that UK thing, because when you're kind of old like me, you've been around and you're conscious of there's a before and an after. And I would say the beginning of the after is 1997. Whatever you can, there's clearly for me and people of my age, there's clearly a before and an after. And if you're in your late 40s, if you're in your 40s. And what I find fascinating is that when you sometimes see a piece of media from the before times that you'd completely forgotten about, it's kind of strange. It's got this hauntological aspect to it where all of a sudden you'd forgotten all about Myra Hindley's face, and it kind of transports you back to a different world. And it's like some relic from being dredged up to be peered at, because the context is that you're looking at this from kind of the UK of 2025 and what we're in now, and yet you still have all of these cultural sort of touchstones exist from the before times, like Only Fools and Horses, for example, or Steve Wright presenting Top of the Pops 2, or Alison Moyet songs. Like they still exist embedded within the collective cultural psyche, even if somebody wasn't born at that time, their parents were. Whereas, and so the thing about Myra Hindley is that firstly, like, she was seen as being almost like a metaphysical incarnation of evil, like a kind of pure demon. And the response to, because then we were a very kind of homogenous, you know, you think of the Moors murders is what we're referring to. If you think of Yorkshire, no, that would have been like 99% white in the 1960s. And so we had this almost sort of inward looking culture. So when one of your own in group sort of goes crazy and becomes evil, that you get this kind of almost like this ritualistic aspect where they have to be lashed out of the village. They have to be like, it's like Myra Hindley became a witch. She wasn't the only one. There was others like Peter Sutcliffe. I think the Bulger killing, the Bulger boys, what went on there, the killing of Jamie Bulger. That has that as well. Like that, remember that that just went on and on and on for months and months and months.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And so in the case of, like, say, just to keep on Myra Hindley, it's as if you've got this idea that you're lashing the witch. The part of your group has become rancid and toxic. And then there's this ritual of getting them out and holding them up. So that the one of the things about Myra Hindley's mugshot is that it was replicated in the newspaper over and over and over again. And then in the 90s, there was a kind of modern artist actually made a print of it using children's hands. And there was hell on about it. It got wrecked. It got smashed. People said it was insensitive. Even Hindley herself, who was still alive, said like she wasn't on board with this. But she said something which was interesting. And she was saying that she was conscious of her image becoming this kind of hyper-real sign of evil in the country. This sort of Baudrillard thing where it's a copy of a replica of a copy, and it goes on and on. But the original woman, the original kind of form, sat sort of dying of in a jail cell, and she was old and decrepit. But that didn't matter anymore. Nobody cared about that, because what she had become was this peroxide blonde sort of mugshot, which had been endlessly replicated and become this sort of icon of evil in the collective British psychology. But this assumes that you've got a collective psychology. You know, you could say, you can go on and on about what that would be and what, but I think it's when it's not too far back and it's kind of around that era that you get some interesting sort of perspectives on things. And Axel Rudi-Gabbana certainly had a startling mugshot. But there was a whole different dynamic going on there, because he wasn't actually, firstly, he's not part of the collective psychology. He probably never heard of Myra Hindley, neither did his parents. None of his parents would have been in this country when she was around. They weren't even in the country when Princess Diana died, which is another kind of cultural touchstone. They weren't here when Tony Blair came into power. They weren't here when the Queen had Annus Mirabilis. So the point is that what's looking back at you in Axel Rudi-Gabbana's mugshot is not actually this kind of spiritual evil which has emanated from your own group. It's just something alien. It's the same goes for the Pakistani mugshots that you see, because we navigate social media and even on the old school media, and we navigate it through all of these signs and symbols that imprint themselves on our brains. And in a way, the Pakistani mugshots of the grooming gangs, where you've got these like sort of five or six grotesque slobs, they always look like the kind of greasy faced, sick, dead eyed bastards. Well, I've got to be careful, because this is what Hope Not Hate came after me for when I talked about their like what I said about their genetics. But their mugshots kind of jump out as well, but not in the sense that something like Myra Hindley's does, because they were never part of our story. They're not part of our collective psychology. And so what happens is they're not us. So you don't have the ritualistic aspect to it. You don't have this kind of inward-looking, one of our group has blown a gasket and become totally mad and crazy. And so you don't sort of turn it into this iconic thing. Instead, it's more like just an ethnic warfare. All you've got looking back at you is like a foreign army. It doesn't have any aura or stuff like that about it.
And a liberal would say that you're othering them by saying this, by feeling this way. But it's completely human. There's nothing you can do about it. That they are other to us. They are not us. And I think it's the same with the Bulger Killers. I think that was 1993, I believe. I remember their mugshots being everywhere. It was these two boys. I think they were 11 years old. And it was the same images, endlessly reprinted. And I think it was probably very similar, if not identical, to the experience with Myra Hindley's mugshot. And so I think as recently as 1993, Britain did have a collective psyche. The British had a collective psyche, and the foreigners were not numerous enough to disrupt that. But I think in this day and age, we don't really have a collective psyche, at least not in the same way. I mean, it's punctured, it's peppered with foreigners. I take the point completely that with Myra Hindley and with the Bulger Killers, there was this sense of we have to look inward. We have to purge ourselves, not individually, but our group, of this terrible tendency. We have to be aware that there is evil abroad. There is evil at home. There is evil in our country. There is evil in our kind. And it's up to all of us to be vigilant and look out for it and look out for each other and all that. Well, when it's a bunch of foreigners, it's a completely different game. It's none of that applies. There's no introspection possible or really necessary. It's just, except to say, why are we putting up with this? Why are we tolerating this? Well, and to ask our government, why are they here? Why are you doing this to us? And that's it. There's not. It's a much, in a way, it's a much simpler situation than that inflicted on us by Myra Hindley. But but at least within that situation, we had agency. In this situation, we don't. It's a case of wishing that the government would take control of this problem and solve it, because God knows if we tried to, if any of us tried to do anything, our lives would be over. I mean, the state that's meant to protect us would destroy us, those individuals. So I think that's the big difference here, is that there is no agency for us. When we see those mugshots of the Pakistani grooming gangs, it's not our group, and therefore it doesn't, well, it shouldn't affect us. They should be in Pakistan. You know, it's perverse that they're even here at all. And so when they do these things, the question isn't, oh, why has this happened? The question is, why are they here? That's the first question. And of course, that's the question that the British people have been asking all along. Again, I did another essay this year about the Great Replacement called Is It Democratic? And I was doing a series about the Great Replacement. And someone suggested that I add this chapter. It hadn't occurred to me. And I'm very glad that someone made that suggestion, because it's probably it's one of the best essays I've written this year. And for that, I studied the election promises of every, like the party that won every election since 1964. Just because that's the starting point, just because we've got good data from that year onwards. The party that won every election from that year onwards, what did they promise the public regarding immigration? Because I wanted to test this idea that the British public voted for mass immigration, that they wanted it, that they approved of it. And it's absolutely remarkable. Every single government, every single party that won office, that became a government, has promised to get immigration under control, which is a euphemism for reducing immigration. And we all know it. And I know that someone could take issue with that, but fuck off. We all know what that means. It's a euphemism for we will reduce immigration. We will stop this thing that you don't like. And when we call it getting it under control, that's what we mean. If we don't mean that, then we don't mean anything. So obviously that's what the British public would take from those words. That's what they would hope the politician meant when he said those words. And every single one of them made that promise. And broadly speaking, ever since Thatcher's second term, every single one of them has broken that promise. And from 1964 to 79, as far as I can tell, the 70s was sort of static in terms of the numbers. They kept coming in, but they didn't increase each year. But then from Thatcher's second term onwards up till now, they have increased pretty much year on year. So it was never democratic. The public, the British public, never wanted this. And this is, I mean, it's a crime. It's a crime that's been done to our people.
Yeah, a big one, the biggest. And it's like the conversation about Brexit as well, which I find interesting, because there's this kind of, you'll see mainly sort of shit libs, but also some on the far right I've seen, where they're like, well, okay, so now there's no more Europeans coming, you're just going to get like endless Indians or Africans or whatever. But the thing is, it was clear. I mean, I was there. I was a grown man. I was watching Brexit. I watched the debates, and it was clear. The messaging was basically, we're going to take control. There'll be far, far, far fewer immigrants coming in. Remember Farage standing there with the lines and lines of people? It was like the migrant crisis at the time. Take back control, all of this. But it's assumed, when you dig in this, it's assumed then, aha, but you should have known. And what they really mean is the average kind of John Bull out there, you know, with his Carling Black Label and his copy of the Mirror, he should have understood that the system was full of sort of lying, lizard-like, reptilian, Machiavellian scumbags. And I feel like, look, he voted to get control of immigration, and then he wanted to leave the European Union and then get back control of the borders. This was at the heart of Brexit. So you can't to say that, well, it's an inevitable sort of result of Brexit, is that you're going to have massive, the Boris wave, for example. I just don't buy that. There has to be a sort of spirit of honesty about this and understanding what people really wanted, because I knew it. It wasn't like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's interesting here because you've got this problem with the self-image of Brexiteers. The left said that Brexit was racist. The left said that Brexiteers were racist. That was why they were voting against the EU. Brexiteers said, oh my God, that's a terrible thing to say. I'm just concerned about the sovereign independence of my country. I'm not racist. But actually they were, in a way. I mean, I don't like the word. I think it's a stupid concept. I mean, basically caring about your country and your people. There's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But that is the motivation behind voting for Brexit. Because, if you care less about that than about bureaucratic procedures, then you're an imbecile. Obviously, the most important thing is the well-being of your ethnic group. That's what everyone else cares about first and foremost. So yeah, I agree. Brexit, it was about independence from the EU because we don't trust it, we don't like it, sure. But the most visceral manifestation of that is mass immigration. Brexiteers wanted control of the borders. They wanted much less immigration. And it was just perverse when the British establishment twisted that and said, okay, so you want less immigration from the EU. That must mean you want more immigration from outside the EU. And I remember even Nigel fucking Farage approving of this and saying that Britain was now going to become a global country. So we can now have immigration. I remember he was talking about India. Unless I've dreamt this, I'm certain that this happened, that he said this. And someone will probably be able to track down these quotes from him around about 2018 when he was saying this. And I guess that brings us to another topic. It does look like Reform are going to win the next election. What are your thoughts on this?
I don't know. I don't like Nigel Farage. I don't like one of the things. I mean, they probably are, and I tell you, if it comes to be like between him and the Green Party, I'll vote for Reform, even though like I know I'm going to get ripped off, even though I know I'm going to be disappointed. I actually think Labour. It's surprising how far to the right Labour are lurching in order to contain this. Like, have you seen that the immigration does look like it's going to come way down for 2025 and all of this? But are they fiddling the numbers, or is it because there's so many people leaving and all of this kind of thing? But in terms of Reform, yeah, we'll see. I'm not hopeful. I'm not very excited about it at all. You know, one of the things, like what I was going to say, is that I saw last week that Bonnie Blue was going to like join Reform, and they didn't just tell her like to go away because she's bad optics and a slag. And I was thinking, like, you know, she probably will end up being welcomed into the party, and it's like, you can't just have a patriotic party. You can't just have a patriotic. Look, I've been a critic of bulldog nationalism and all of that for years. I get it, right? The sort of Piers Morgan bulldog nationalism. And we'll get on with that maybe later, but you know what I mean? And instead, it's like you can have the ice cream, but there has to be flakes of dog shit in it. You have to have, like, literally the biggest whore on earth to be welcomed in because, I don't know, liberty or, like, capitalism. She's a good capitalist. She's made a lot of money. And you can't, it's coded in a way of being critical of Islam because, you know, it's sort of borderline Tommy Robinson and all that. But then you have to have like a Muslim in charge. So you've always got to compromise. You always get the kind of the fly in your paint. Honestly, you can't just have a patriotic party, even if it was just bulldog nationalist values. You've always got to have that bit of compromise. You've always got to have that blue bottle that dives into the foam of your beer on a warm summer day. So, and it's like, well, do I drink it still, or do I just pull it out, or do I get a new pint, or what? This is what I hate about it. It's funny because the same thing seems to be in America as well. Like the dilemma that they had with Trump, and it was like, yeah, but he's going to be like this Israeli firster, and he's going to put them first, and you're not going to get what you want. And then it's like, well, okay, what do we do? Just sort of vote for Kamala? See, you could say that I'm just being naive, and this is, oh, well, politics is all about compromise and negotiation. But is really, I mean, that's why I'm going to vote for the party who's got the biggest slag on earth, like sort of shilling it. Come on, eh?
I mean, look, Reform didn't need to do this. I think they did this within the last 7 days. 2 weeks ago and, you know, 8 days ago, they were on course to win the next election. And that's not likely to change as far as I can see. They didn't need to bring Bonnie Blue on board. But they fucking chose to do it. And I don't even think it's a slap in the and a calculated slap in the face by Nigel Farage. I think he's just a con man and a showman. And I don't think that anything really matters to him. I think he's... this is all just for the show. It's exciting. We'll have... Everyone knows Bonnie Blue. Sure, bring her on. She's famous. She's famous, so add her to the roster. It's so tacky and shallow and grubby. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say because it's entirely unnecessary and actually it's self-harming. But and maybe it is deliberately. Maybe there's some plan here where they'll disgust conservatives so then they won't vote for Reform, so then Reform won't win the next election. But I don't think so. I think this is just sheer grubbiness.
It's just so depressing. I've listened to some of the other streams, and you can have these kind of uplifting kind of, you can go off on these kind of happy tangents or a bit more circumspect and everything. And I find it difficult to do with Britain these days, because when you like, on the one hand, you don't want to like dwell on all the misery and the horror, because as we're doing this now, I'm sort of thinking, Jesus, everybody must be. This is Christmas Eve. This is like a Happy Christmas. this is Merry Christmas out there, everybody. They've had rape. They've had ethnic cleansing. They've had corruption. They've had Bonnie Blue. Like, what do you want? What do you want for your Christmas Eve on a right wing stream? And I do kind of think of myself, you know what I mean? And I do think like, you got to kind of. Bring a bit of levity, you know what I mean? But then again, like, you think, yeah, but the country is shit. Like, it's very easy to get into this sort of cope and like to become an Anglo futurist and pretend that you're going to have like a monorail which goes to the reclaimed Doggerland or whatever. And I'm just like, really? I don't even mind that kind of idealism, but I'm also thinking, yeah, really, like, have you seen like the news like every single day? Is it? And they'll say, well, all you do is marrow in the horror and the gore and the misery of it all. And I suppose that's accurate as well. I suppose they're right in a way. But it's so easy in the UK these days that you feel this weight on you all of the time. There's this kind of this heaviness of the sheer state of the country. And it isn't just that there's lots of immigrants here. It's because you know the people in the institutions are completely indifferent to your suffering. Or the suffering of people like us, of your people, they do not care. And if you speak out about it, they're going to set goon squads on you. They'll do ops. They'll get you deplatformed. People go to jail every day for tweets. And it's difficult. It's difficult to have an optimistic, idealistic perspective just because of the reality that you're living in. Now, this is not to say that in our private lives we should be wandering around feeling miserable. That's not it at all. But when you kind of zoom out a little bit and do some commentary on the country or the state of the West, it's a pretty bleak view. It's not to say that we should all just be depressed in our day-to-day lives, but it is. And that, I don't see the need of dressing it up and coping. You just have to kind of look it straight in the face. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think it's time to do that. Look, if I thought things were hopeless, if I thought this was just heading for oblivion, basically, then I wouldn't be able to stand talking about it and dwelling on it. I couldn't do it. I would want to just find some sweet thing and think about that and just live out my days, you know, just distract myself from the oncoming horror, because there's nothing, if we can't do anything about it, if the situation is hopeless, then we should just find some sort of comfort while we can and just die. And then that's it. But I don't think the situation is hopeless. And that's why I can dwell on this to some extent. Even then, I still distract myself. I've been watching Red Dwarf during Millennial. I dug out my old DVDs and I've been watching that. For example, I think that it's, you know, I have a laugh with friends and so on. So I don't dwell on this all the time. And I really certainly don't want to give people misery at Christmas. That's the last thing I want to do. But I don't think the situation is hopeless. So therefore, I don't see this as a council of despair. I don't think I'm poisoning, well, I hope I'm not poisoning people's morale or confidence or optimism. I want people to be optimistic. And indeed, in choosing the guests this year, I specifically looked for people who are doing things, who are making progress, so as to show an example to other people that they can be inspired by and follow and so forth. But at the same time, the analysis of what's going on is going to be downbeat, because there's no way to sugarcoat it. We are, you know, our kids are getting raped. The government is bringing in mass numbers of guys who are thick as shit and violent and impulsive and are going to do this and are doing this. It's not even, I don't think it's even controversial. I mean, it's obvious that this is happening. So it's obviously going to be downbeat commentary. But if I thought the situation were hopeless, I wouldn't do this. I wouldn't allow downbeat commentary at Christmas or whatever. I'd just say, look, here are some nice things. Here's how I'm distracting myself from the fucking nightmare. Having said that, I still do a bit of that. You know, my TV guides this year. I'm sorry to keep shilling my Substack, but it keeps becoming relevant. I've written two in particular that I really liked, about two shows, Rising Damp and New Scotland Yard. And I keep rereading those because it's nice. It's like, it's nice to celebrate something. It feels good to celebrate a good thing. And I think that's important. But that doesn't negate the reality of the world that we're in now. And we are going to have to deal with it. We are, and each of us individually is going to have to contend with it. So I think it has to be talked about.
Yeah, and I think when it's, there is something to be said as well, that we have been like scoring some wins. Like, it does seem clear to me that even the Labour government is kind of alienating their woke flank, if you like, in order to say, like, we can't just rule, we can't just allow the country to go down this way without doing something about it, because it undermines their own power. This is the thing, like the pure kind of malice argument. I get it and I kind of agree with it, but you reach a point where if you're just going to have this sort of hard, sort of cruel and vindictive regime, that tends to be quite brittle. You know, when Keir Starmer had just got into power and he went as a lot of the stuff that's happening is not actually the fault of the Labour government, it's the fault of the Tories. But, you know, we're getting 18 months in now and it's time for them to like show that they actually give a shit, which they kind of do sometimes, and then other times they just spit in your face. It's like schizophrenic. Because on the one hand, they've got to go for their woke left flank. And on the other hand, I don't think it's just about pandering to reform. I think it's just that the stability of the country is at stake here. All through this summer, I did a piece called The Summer of Kindling. Because all through this summer, there was this kind of feeling that if we get one atrocity too much, or one atrocity that just happens to hit the algorithm in a certain way, or the country's going to go up in flames. Everybody felt it. The government, you had all of this stuff about the government were going to have reserves on the ready, and police forces were going to be on standby, and they were going to have emergency measures for social media posts that went viral. And it was like, people in focus groups and whatnot, they're going to be looking at this thinking, this is not stable. We can't have a country which is on the edge of sort of mass violence or unrest and riots, which could just flame up at any time. And the question is, what can they do about it? Because they're left wing. It's as if they have to go against the grain of all of their core principles.
That's because the Conservatives have been so left wing before them,
yeah,
that they now have to deal with the results of left wing policy.
Yeah, and by the millions as well. They still there?
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, how long can this situation go on for? Is it the case that forevermore now, Britain is going to be perpetually on the brink of civil unrest? Because like the situation this summer, is that just going to be what life in Britain is like, you know, in the year 2300? I mean, I certainly hope not, and I don't think it will be. I think this is a fairly temporary condition, and I think it will worsen every summer. There's something about the heat. I don't know what it is, but for some reason in the summer, this stuff gets worse. It's been like that, I don't know, since 2017 kind of time. I don't know. And now with the migrant hotels and Southport last year, that was at the height of summer, August, July. And yeah, is it just going to be endless tension now? Is that because that is the situation that they have created? And again, I think an annoying thing for Conservatives, like bog standard Conservatives, is they can't blame this on Labour. And I think a lot of them would like to. They'd like to say, New Labour, it's their immigration policy. But it's the Conservatives who've been in for the last 14 years. As I said earlier, the Thatcher government, the immigration increased year on year under them. And now David Cameron brought in gay marriage in 2010. And then they were obsessed with the trans stuff throughout the 2010s. And they were hugely increasing immigration all through that, culminating with the Boris wave, which I think was double the size of the previous year's immigration. So just astonishing. And of course, to call that a right-wing government is just mad. And then I guess Labour voters would say that to call Starmer's government left-wing is kind of mad. Because nothing is ever left-wing enough for the progressive. And I think that's why the Green Party has been sort of activated. I think that's an interesting thing in itself. I mean, do you have any theory? I've put this to other people. Is it the case that the mainstream parties, the traditional parties, Labour and Conservative, have become so discredited that the establishment has realised we've got to replace them. So we're going to activate, energise, reform on the right to replace the Conservatives, and the Green Party on the left to replace Labour. Is that what's going on here, do you?
It looks like it. The Green Party and that Zach Polanski are like I've never seen an AstroTurf operation on that scale. I find them like repulsive, absolutely repulsive to look at. And I think he's a moron. I think it's kind of like it's their peak woke, just as woke is going out of fashion. And their policies seem deliberately designed to like piss off the common Englishman. It baffles me, because if you look at that Shabama Mahmood, and she's now coming out with these kind of based things about what they're going to do and how difficult they're going to make it, like at least she's kind of leaning toward what common people think. But the Green Party's going in a total different direction. And yet they're being pushed all of... It's definitely AstroTurf. I mean, I don't know why... In terms of replacing the Labour Party, I don't know why you would do that, not just replace Keir Starmer. So that's what they've been doing for the last 100 years or so. Like, I don't know why they would kind of do that. It just mystifies me. I mean, I have thought that, like, you know how the left have been complaining that Nigel Farage is never off the telly. And when I'm like kind of, oh, it's just them moaning. Maybe there's something to that. Like, maybe Farage is also AstroTurfed, all those appearances on Question Time and all the rest of it. But because of our bias, we just didn't really pay attention to it, and we just thought it was them. Because looking at it from the other side, the Green Party and what's going on there, I've never seen an AstroTurf operation, anything like it. So somebody somewhere with clout definitely wants to push them. Is it to put pressure on Labour to tell them not to go too far to the right? Or I don't know. I know one thing. I think they're mad. I just everything about them just makes me sick. I feel sick looking at them. I feel sick by how retarded they are. And it's not like that. The Green Party of the past was kind of like the Lib Dems for the English Shires,
middle class liberal.
Yeah, this is like sort of they've got like. It's more like a sort of university plus Islam. But even then, I mean, what I will say is that they are in the slot that would normally be occupied by Jeremy Corbyn. So you had that total shambles, which was called Your Party or something, where basically they were trying. There's an opening on the left for an anti-Zionist party with the Galloway, Corbyn types, and the Muslims, so that there's a kind of niche there waiting to be filled. And it seems to me that the Green Party is there being AstroTurfed to fill that, so that you don't get a kind of Galloway plus the Muslims, who are much more, who'll make the establishment uncomfortable with what they'd say about the situation in the Middle East with Palestine and all the rest of it. So I think what's really going on is that kind of nexus of, because you've got more and more independent Muslims going into Parliament now, and they're all going in on the pro-Palestine ticket and being anti-Israel. And I think they're worried that something will coalesce on the left of Labour, and they're going to have the Corbyn problem again. And what that Zach Polanski is really is a convenient backstop, so that he's there to soak up those votes. Now you could say that what's interesting about that is that when you then look over to the right, you really have to question Reform's role and say, well, is that not what they are on the right? Because again, lefties have been saying for years that Farage is never off the telly.
Yeah. And you know, maybe they're right. And exactly as you say, we didn't see it because we weren't objecting to it as strongly. Just before we get to that, I should acknowledge that I first heard of this from Academic Agent. I want to give him credit for this, because it hadn't occurred to me that the reason for energizing the Greens under Zach Polanski was to stymie Jeremy Corbyn. And it's worth saying Jeremy Corbyn is anti-Zionist, but there's a, and he's not anti-Jew, he's not, you know, whatever, but there's a danger that a Muslim party could easily become, it could go from anti-Zionist to anti-Semitic. And I think this might be the thing with the Green Party. Zach Polanski is Jewish and he is anti-Zionist. But by definition, he can't be anti-Jew. So, well, I mean, unless he's going to be a self-hating Jew, but there's no sign of that. So I think that's the nature of this backstop. It's the Green Party will attract anti-Zionists and pro-Palestine people, but will prevent them from making that connection, from going further in that direction, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. But I've never heard him mention Israel at all or the Palestinians.
I looked it up. He describes himself as definitely not right. A Zionist.
Well, in right, that's fine. But in terms of the messaging that you see, the little clips on social media and the talking points, what I get is infinity asylum seekers. To tax the rich and like green bollocks. And there's like what I mean is if you tuned in to George Galloway's live stream, I can guarantee within the first 2 minutes you will have a diatribe against the neocons, against Zionists, against Israel, and probably against the Labour Party as well, and against the Anti-Defamation League. You'll get the vibe straight away. That you know where Galloway is coming from. Corbyn's like that as well, but a bit more sort of genteel and a bit more muted in the way that he speaks. But with that, Zach Polanski, you just don't get that. It just feels to me that somebody's spitting in my face. You see these clips and you see the talking points and it just never seems to be addressed. And I think it's there to soak up that energy, to be a backstop against having to deal with all of that again. But yeah, the fact that he's a Jew may sort of figure into it as well.
And a gay Jew as well.
where
I mean, it's like a wet dream. Sorry, go on.
I just hate it that like it gets back to what I was saying right at the beginning where it's just this deafness to suffering. There was something happened, and I went into his replies, and I ratioed them by thousands and thousands. And it was something had happened. There was like one of the daily atrocities, and he is out on the day after it happened, saying we just need to settle them, all of them, forever. And you can it takes you to a dark place because. Again, it's like what I was saying about Shukman at the start, but it takes you to this dark place because you're looking into eyes who have no sympathy for you or your people whatsoever. Nothing. He knows because he's bombarded with it every day. And I'm picking on him because it's kind of endemic to the entire structure. And so in this case, Polanski knows that, for example, that the day before there was a girl abducted and molested in a park by Afghanis, and that the day before that there was another story, and then a day before that there was another story, and on and on and on and on. He knows. And yet, despite that, he'll come out and say more. We want more of these people in the country. I don't know. I don't know what you do with that. Like we're really heading into some kind of dangerous place here. But just in terms of like looking at it, I mean, he's got these horrible dead eyes as well, like doll's eyes. You know, they came off there. Quint says on Jaws that you're looking into it just in terms of empathy and human warmth and reason. It's just an abyss. It's just nothing. It's like something from a Cormac McCarthy book. You know, there's this sort of just deadness to it, that where you think you post a screenshot in their, not just him, it's all of them in the replies, like they see that, like day in day out, and does it not grind them down? When is it enough? I can't understand it. That if it was me, I would be thinking, I cannot handle this anymore. I would at least delete the account. I would at least try to shy away from it. But they're staring at it every day, the misery and the rapes and the gore and the atrocities. And their values have brought this upon us, and they don't give a shit. And they look at the latest one, the latest mugshot, the latest headlines, the latest horror, and they'll not budge one iota in their position. I just find this takes us to a really dark place.
Yes, I agree. It's appalling. And again, you realize, okay, so, well, this is what it is to be ruled by foreigners, that this, that they simply don't have any empathy whatsoever. And they see you as a problem that has to be eliminated. Or at any rate, I mean, the most charitable interpretation is they see you and me, the likes of you and me, as a problem that has to be dealt with. But the general British people, they're happy to subject to unlimited degradation. And they assume that, well, the degradation, yes, it's bad, but we'll get it under control. But how? If you can't control it now at the current numbers, how on earth are you going to control it with even bigger numbers of them here? So that's just crazy. It's completely irrational. The obvious conclusion is you've got no intention of getting it under control, and that's why you're happy to have even more of them here. You don't care. You don't fucking care about getting it under control. So I don't know. I just think these people, I mean, any white person who supports that, who supports Zach Polanski, is insane, but that's not a good enough explanation either, because we know they're not. You can't have that sheer numbers of insane people in society, but let's just say that they are behaving insanely. But that brings me to another thing that I wanted to bring into this, and this was just uploaded yesterday. You've probably seen it on Twitter, and it links with something you were saying earlier. This is what made me think of it when you were saying liberal, progressive journalists and so on just seem to have no ability to process reality. So I'm going to play this clip now.
Hey, Malcolm, you've said things like, Black women are biologically different than white women.
They have different fertility windows. They have a higher rate of fertility complications, 50%.
But there's no scientific evidence to prove that a Black woman and a white woman are genetically different, right? This is like,
what are you talking about?
This is according, yeah. No.
But like literally, there are genes that code for their skin color.
This is like government data. This is EMI, right? This is the National Institute of Health. This is the American Medical Association. Like there is no scientific evidence to prove that.
And that's a big problem, right? Because
there's no scientific evidence to prove things like IQ differences. Black people are genetically different from other populations.
And I'll say that again. There is no scientific evidence to prove that, right? And as people
do you want to ask an AI if there's scientific evidence to prove that?
No, I want to ask.
Just factually incorrect. Humans are genetically diverse. It's not a bad thing that humans are genetically diverse.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad or a good thing. I'm saying there is no scientific evidence.
And I'm saying that is a factual.
He's saying that there is scientific
evidence. There is scientific evidence. There is overwhelming scientific evidence.
Based on
this is like saying the sky is not blue. Like, It is genes that code their skin color, mm-hmm. right? Those genes are obviously different in them than they are in us. How is that not science? That's just like a basic fact. The genes that code their skin color, their level of melanin production, are different from my genes that code melanin production.
And that's precisely why I was asking this question, because I think for some people that do believe, like you, that people are genetically different, that has historically been used to promote racial hierarchies, right? And that's why I'm asking you. Because,
but so what because you do...
So, it's unbelievably...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry? That's the first time you've seen it?
I've seen it going around. I didn't watch it, yeah, because I knew I'd be irritated by it. Well, yeah.
Right, sorry. Well, staggeringly, that woman actually put that up on her Instagram. Right, she's not ashamed of it. She's not embarrassed. She even now she can't see that she was completely in the wrong there, and that she was demonstrating incredible irrationality. She's proud of it. She's put it up on her Instagram. And the thing is, what you see there is complete. Like she just, it's. You go first.
Well, the disconnect is that. The institutional power backs the lie, not science. That's why James Watson got unpersoned and all the rest of it. So then she's in this situation where it's kind of like, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but you are in the 1984 scenario where power demands that your truth is untruth, and that's it. And basically, that's where she's coming from. It's not rational, it's not reasonable, but she's got the institutions on her side and she knows it. And so if the sky is pink and not blue, then that's just how it has to be. This is the territory that you get into.
And the other thing towards at the very end there, she says this belief that races are genetically different has been used to justify racial hierarchies. So if a belief or a fact could be used in a bad way, therefore we have to nullify that fact. So we'll believe the opposite so that that effect can't happen. She's basically says that. That's why, well, I mean, she doesn't say it explicitly, but that is why she will not accept that the races are genetically different, even though nothing could be more obvious. Now, nothing could be more obviously true than, of course, two black parents will have a black child, two white parents will have a white child. How is that not genetically governed? Of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, what the fuck else could it be? Of course it is. It's genetic.
And
There's
a gene that would make black people have crinkly hair. To give them their kind of crinkly curly afros. There's a gene that does that. Now, that's not a judgment. I'm not saying whether that's good or bad. There's a gene in a kangaroo that will make it hop. The muscles in its legs and this kind of thing. It's not a judgment. It's not to say that I don't like kangaroos or what. It's just an objective empirical fact. And it's like, well, that's a problem because of what it might mean in terms of her ideology. I mean, what one of the things that I was going to get into with the Green Party, which funny enough goes into this, is that it turns out that somewhere in Sussex, you had this thing happened this year where Rachel Millward of the Green Party, I think she's like the deputy leader or something, and. So she's been refugees welcome. She's been campaigning for years and years, bring them in, the more the merrier. And it just turns out that she's got this old army barracks in her constituency. And so she, you saw this, didn't you? So she got the call.
Yeah, yeah.
She got the call from the Starmerites. And they said, well, you know, That's a nice little hamlet in Sussex you've got going there. Be ashamed of something what happened to it. And basically, it was like, well, we're going to house asylum seekers in that barracks. Now, this again, it's just amazing that So now she's on it. Now she's got a problem. Now, to be fair, her constituents didn't want this. The people in her area were, they had like this town meeting and they were all screaming blue murder and telling her just to resign. But in her mind, I thought this, she actually rejected it. She's been campaigning for years and years and years. Apparently she's got a 6-bedroom mansion and all of this. And then when it comes time for the rubber to hit the road, when it's going to be gangs of men from Afghanistan or whatever milling around the local school, taking pictures of the girls going to school in their uniforms on their phones, when that's on its way to her place, she rejected it. She kind of got it at some instinctual level and had to come up with like a pack of cope. And she was saying, like, the way that she got out with it was to say basically that we shouldn't be housing anybody in army barracks. Instead, they should just be given houses somewhere, so somewhere far away from her. But the issue was that as a point of principle, she was just so woke and so loving and caring that that she was just against them being housed in an army barracks because that's barbaric. And it's like, hang on a minute. On the one hand, you want us to believe that these people are all fleeing for their lives, they're in danger, they're being persecuted. What exactly is wrong with an army barracks and that? Like, hello? So now, what, they're going to die in the Channel? They're going to be stuck in France? That's the humane option. And it's all, again, it's all lies. It's all lies and bullshit with these people. She knew what the risks were. She even said it. She even let it slip out. Oh, well, and first she added the, like, it'll be a risk to the asylum seekers and also to our, the people of the area. And it's like, well, so somebody else will get them. Somebody else will just be put at risk. And I just found the hypocrisy, it just makes you want to vomit. And it's like, she wants the virtue signal, but she doesn't want to have the consequences. But that then implies that she knows of the consequences. Because otherwise, if she was just this kind of airy-fairy, libtard idealist, she'd be like, yeah, fine, and I'll round up all the locals and they can bring coffee cake to the men in the barracks. We'll help them out. We'll help them decorate the barracks. But no, it was like, it's too bad. You can't do that. That's too cruel. We can't have that here. And it's just... All of the institutions are stuffed with these bastards. This is why everything in Britain just make it's like you're suffocating on this crap.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing to watch. With her, it was like a perfect demonstration. It couldn't have been constructed to be more perfect as a demonstration of the. Well, the hypocrisy. I mean, basically, it's NIMBYism. They're just not in my army barracks. So put them in someone else's. Put them in someone else's vicinity of someone else's school girls or whatever. But just don't make me have to answer to my constituents for it. I mean, it's repulsive because, as you say, it's going to be putting them in houses. I mean, her ideal solution, presumably, would be put them in houses somewhere else. I don't know. It's untenable. It's unsustainable. You can't, as you say, army barracks would be better than letting them die. So obviously, that's the right option if you're going to assume that everyone's the same and so forth. So yeah, it just falls apart. It just falls apart against reality. And you say that the institutions are all full of this stuff. I agree. The interesting question is, to what extent do they understand? And this gets to my famous tweet, which, it was partly inspired by the hatchling, the hatchling concept. But, I mean, I've been saying for years on Twitter to people, well done, you managed to miss the point. I've said it 1,000 fucking times on there because it's happened so many times that someone, you'll say a perfectly simple thing and they'll misunderstand it or, you know, pretend to. And then you say, oh, well done. So now you don't have to answer the argument because you've undermined it from the start. Yeah. So that was why I said that. And I said it off the cuff. For 6 months, nobody noticed. And then someone shared it and it went viral and it's still going viral. I still see it all the time. My timeline is just fucking chock full of that tweet. And it's nice, but to me, it was so obvious. I didn't even think it was worth writing at the time, which is why I didn't really finesse the wording. But the point is, and this is what I want to put to you, is to what extent, and I think the answer is, because people said they're not pretending to misunderstand. They genuinely don't get it. They genuinely don't understand. And I think the answer has to be that it's just sometimes they're pretending and others genuinely don't understand. Like, they're not that bright. They're bright enough to grasp. Like, I mean, with that clip that I showed a few minutes ago, that woman, I saw someone pointing this out on Twitter, she's able to hold down a job. She's got 35,000 Twitter followers or something like that. She's got a book coming out. She's accomplished. She's, you know, got a stable life. She's not insane and she's not thick. And yet, look what she said in that clip. I mean, so it's this very strange situation where I don't know whether they are pretending or not. I don't actually know. I think sometimes they must be, but a lot of the time they simply don't. And it's not because they simply don't understand. And it's not because they're thick. It's because the thing violates. It's like O'Brien said in 1984 that the thing violates your beliefs. Therefore, you must reject it immediately. Just in and of itself, it can't be true. Because if it is true, that might lead to this conclusion. So it's like preemptive blindness. I don't know. Yeah, what do you?
Part of the problem is that all of the incentives are skewered in such a way. Like I said before, she knows that she's got power backing her up. So what you, and the problem is, what constitutes power is retarded and wrong. And so you end up getting these kind of weird outcomes like that, where it's everything seems to be a bit disjointed, and it's like you're screaming at a lunatic. I was on the Jay Burden show last week, and I had a chat with him, and again, you kind of get bogged down in the misery and how crap it is in this country now. And one of the things that I said was like, I'd rather we had a weak king than this current system. Like, I'm not even talking about, like, I mean, if he was fully in charge, even a Muppet like Charles or William, or let's just like a weak king. I'd prefer to have a weak king over, I'm not talking about Edward Longshanks or having a Cromwell or anything like that, or Henry VIII. I'm saying I'd rather have a weak and pathetic king than this. Because one of the things that I thought about, especially I wrote on this on watching The Crown, is that if you look, because my missus is obsessed with all the royal slop and, you know, gossip. But one of the things that I've noticed about the royals is that they're obsessed with PR. They're obsessed with the public and the masses not liking them. It terrifies them. I watched the whole of the series of The Crown, and everything in The Crown, all of the storylines, all of the character arcs, or everything about it is rooted in not embarrassing the family, the firm, and not sort of making us ashamed. You'll notice recently, because there's more and more stuff coming out about Epstein, that they kind of unpersoned Andrew weeks ago to get ahead of this. It was just like, drop him, get rid of him. And that was a scandal because it dragged on for so long. And you just get, it's like time and time again, that they're just terrified and pathetic worrying about how everybody may view them, how people may think badly of the Queen Elizabeth II and all of this kind of thing. And the problem with the actual managerial government, the state and all of its apparatus, is that it doesn't give a shit because you don't know who to blame. I mean, that woman who was denying about the genetics, who is responsible for misinforming her, or who was responsible for her being there in the first place? And who was responsible for the migrants arriving in East Sussex? You know, who would be responsible if they were kind of forced on them? Would it be a lawyer or a judge or a human rights protocol or Keir Starmer or Shabama Mahmood or who?
And some civil servant.
Some civil servant. We don't know, really. And what happens is that they pass it on to this or that other bureaucracy. But if you've got a kind of a figurehead who is obsessed with being liked, because that's all there is, there is nothing else around him, because he's just alone at the top, a proper sovereign, even a weak king would have an incentive to not fuck over his own people. And if he did, then it's a disaster. And it gets to the point where you think, I cannot imagine a worse system than what we've got. Because even, you know, you're supposed to kind of hate monarchy right from the off, even a good king. But it gets to the point where you think, I'd have a bad king. I'd have a weak king over this. I'd have a William over this. If he just abolished Parliament and took it on himself. Because his incentives are completely different to Keir Starmer's or, you know, the civil servants and all of these.
Keir Starmer's the opposite, as has been said repeatedly this year. He doesn't seem to care at all whether he's liked by the public.
Yeah.
And it's striking.
Yeah, he does not care. Which we never even touched on it, but the digital IDs are finally on the way.
Yeah. I think in the British context, it's important to say New Labour were really up for this a long time ago, the mid-2000s. It was the national ID card, and they were obsessed with it. And again, at that time, nobody wanted it. And eventually, it actually didn't happen. I think what happened was that they'd put it into law, or they'd prepared a law, and when the Tories came in 2010, it just got discarded. I think, I might be wrong, but I think that's how it happened. Because it was extremely unpopular. Nobody wanted it. But Tony Blair did. He was obsessed with it. And now everyone knows what's happened. He's built up his power base ever since then. It's kind of like Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, once he got, once he left 10 Downing Street, he actually became more powerful. So, I mean, it's amazing because it was always the thing. I think you might have pointed this out, that a prime minister would leave office and then just sort of disappear to the back benches. And it would be weird, 5 years later, you'd see him as just this backbencher, sort of just looking after his constituents. And that was it. It was very humble. But with him, it's the opposite. It's ever more grandiose and connected to umpteen NGOs and so on. So anyway, he's one way or another. I mean, it might not even be directly because of him. For whatever reason, the Labour Party are now bringing in digital ID. And I think the petition, I think it got just under 2 million signatures. Let me see. Do not introduce digital ID cards. It's just under 3 million. 3 million. So, and the response from government was lackluster, disinterested, and just simply sticking to the course. The response simply said, no, we're going to do this. They did make the caveat that it's not a card. It's not a digital ID card. Don't worry, you're not getting a digital ID card. But you are fucking getting digital ID. So you've obviously written a lot about this over the years. You've been called a schizo for doing so at times. I was always on board with this. I always thought this is a real threat ever since the COVID time. And then we sort of forgot about it for a few years because it fell out of the discourse. And other things came up. Immigration came back in. And then Gaza and all that. So, and then out of the blue, Starmer announced that it was going to come. I don't know if there was even any build-up to it, but it was around about July this year. It was announced he's going to announce it tomorrow. I think that was how it played out. And he gave this speech in which he said, in order to get a job or to rent a room or presumably to buy a house, you know, basically to have to do anything, to have a life, to do the basics, the essentials of life, you have to have a digital ID. And of course, there was that clip of him saying, no, you don't have to do it. It's like, you don't have to get vaccinated. You just won't be able to have a fucking life if you don't. And we're going to make sure of it. So presumably, you would say this is all about surveillance and it's really nothing. Because there is no need for this. According to life as we live it, as we've been living it for decades in the West, we've always done without digital ID. We never needed it. But Tony Blair really wanted it in 2004, and now Starmer really wants it in 2025. And,
I think it's coming in everywhere. I think it's there's kind of, it's there in embryonic form in a lot of states in America as well. The European Union's bringing it in. It's coming everywhere. And I think it's the actual digital ID thing's just going to be the start of it. It is what we said it was going to be. You can even see, I mean, I go back to what I was talking about earlier with what amounts to, like, how the Hope Not Hate, the Home Office, and facial recognition technology. So all of this is meshing together. It's all beginning to lock together, along with the online harms bill. So if you look at Substack now, you've got that thing where you have to, it's going to happen that more and more stuff. For example, John Carter's last article was blocked. I got a VPN now, but his John Carter's last Substack article about the DEI hiring and white men and stuff, that was blocked. So I just wouldn't have been able to read that unless I verified myself. And to verify myself, I would have. Well, there's a kind of funny little thing that happens with the email, which you, if you can expand it on there, you know, when you get sent an email. But if you go on the actual Substack itself, you couldn't read it. And so this will be more and more. And I've said it for years that it's in the nature. You perform of a video game. It's gamified. You perform the task and then you're allowed to proceed. You perform the task and then you're allowed to proceed. And I still can't access the messages, the message thing on Substack. So, of course, if you had a digital ID and you were hooked up to that, it's basically begging for it. It's begging for a digital ID to immediately log in, because then it's going to know who you are. So you can see that these are a lot of problems are being created for a digital ID to solve. And the online harms bill is just creating lots of them on purpose, because if you had a digital ID, you're automatically age verified. So and this is basically what they've been doing. They've been setting up all of these barriers for years, and then they're going to come along and wave the digital ID in your face as a way to sort of get bypass all of this stuff. But then I just find it horrifying, the lack of resistance. It came out like a week or two back that they're basically just rolling digital facial recognition technology out all over the country. So then, you know, if you're driving, I went for a lovely trip through Scotland this year, and you can be passing through some quiet little village in Scotland, but there'll be a camera on there, and it'll kind of screen you, and then it'll immediately attach to your digital ID. So then, in the kind of on the back end, It'll know where you are, like, immediately. And they'll have these, maybe they'll have these cameras, like, everywhere, literally everywhere. And it'll just, you'll be getting scanned. They'll know where you've gone, what you've bought, what you've done. And all of this is just there, just a record of you, everything about you. And here's the problem. If the system that's bringing this in seems to give carve-outs in the Home Office to scumbags and vermin. So, if you see, the Chinese have got this kind of thing, but I can't imagine, like, one, that there's a lot of corruption in China, but I can kind of imagine that the Chinese people are just kind of used to it. One thing I have seen is that apparently the streets of some of the biggest cities in China are riddled with people. It's like we've got this big problem with homelessness because they don't have the credit points on their social credit system to actually get an apartment. They don't cross that threshold, so now more and more people are homeless in China. This is that's maybe a bit too far, but something like that is happening. We can already see who's got access to what. So, like, I'm on the shit list of a social credit system already, before it's even come in. I've literally got them going, like, my suspicion is, you know, that this kind of dodgy NGO use its carve out to get the facial recognition technology to get and find out where I ordered a passport from. That's my suspicion, which I can't prove because they don't tell you these things. But that would be for everybody on everything. Everybody's going to be doxxed. Sorry. That's coming for everybody, whether you've got 20 followers on Twitter I think I was the last one who isn't, dog. But even like normal people, just the normies, it's over. That's where this is going now. And people, so it's like the worst of everything. Not only have you got this authoritarian surveillance state unrolling before your eyes, but it's also going to be corrupt. It's also going to let scumbags in on the back end to access private data.
Yeah.
So I don't know what to say. It's bad. Mm.
Yeah. Do you think that this will... again, the question is Nigel Farage, because I think it's going to take a long time to roll this out. And Keir Starmer said it would be within his parliament. I mean, it's kind of like the moon. Like we will land a man on the moon within this decade. I can maybe if they really set their minds to it, they can pull this off. But I think more likely it's going to be something that will take 10, 15 years. And by that time, Labour will be out. Almost certainly, Reform will be in. There was one theory that came up this millennial that. That Nigel Farage and Reform are actually going to be the ones who implement this for real, that they're not going to scrap all this shit and the Online Safety Act and Ofcom. It's actually going to be a right-wing government that really implements this left-wing program. Let's leave the left-right thing out of this. It's going to be a so-called libertarian government that implements this authoritarian program. And that they'll do that under the auspices of whatever national security. But the thing is, I can't remember who I said this to. It was someone on Millennial that I think they've had this ability for years anyway. I mean, if the British state wanted to know where I am right now, they'd be able to find out within seconds. I'd be very surprised if they couldn't piece it together. If they don't have an algorithm already that just does it in a nanosecond. So what's the use of the digital ID? And I think this is maybe, well, you talked about facial recognition, so they would always be able to, it simplifies it for them in a way. It adds massive amounts of new data to the picture for them.
Yeah,
I mean, what is the point of digital ID? Given that they've had these abilities for a long, long time, what's the point of the digital ID?
It's just consolidating everything in one device. It's consolidating everything that already exists, and it's a sort of more efficient form in one device, connected with your bank and everything else. This is the thing. A lot of people are going to be fine with it. A lot of people are going to find that it's really handy. Or I can go everywhere, and I just need to scan me phone. It's perfectly fine. It's like the people in the government, a lot of these people are probably thinking it's going to be helpful to everybody. It's going to first come in on the back end of the tax thing. That's the one ID or something like that. And a lot of people may think, I find this really handy. It's streamlined everything. It's grand. And in fact, most people are probably going to think that. The problem is if you find yourself on the wrong side of it, it's when it begins to kind of buck back where things are going to get uncomfortable. But we'll see. I mean, as for Farage, I don't even think it's an inherently sort of left wing thing. But I do think it's, as I say, it's coming in. Farage is not going to do anything about this. I think the online harms bill, he'll have to have a sort of back and forth with Trump and the Americans, because all of this is sort of, you've got the people like Larry Ellison who's rolling all of this stuff up, and then you go into the AI stuff. It's possible that all of this is just too top-heavy and too bureaucratic on the back end. I mean, one of the problems that they've got is AI is it's not looking as solid as what people were thinking. The amount of data centers and energy that it's taking, the fact that they've got this weird, incestuous sort of thing where they're all investing in each other and it just goes round and round and round. All of this doesn't bode well. It isn't like the sort of what Elon Musk promised of this great, what do they call it? UBI, paradise, techno-communist of the future. It looks like it's just going to suck all of the energy of the world to power it and then collapse everything. It's not looking good at all. Which
it's like something from a sci-fi cartoon. Sorry.
That's not necessarily a bad thing that it's going to go that way. I mean, one of the things about the digital ID, it was justified on to track down all of these immigrants. So it is interesting because you can think like, so was that the reason that you just allowed this small boats thing to go on for year after year? Like, you could have actually stopped it whenever you wanted. I mean, I think we all know they could have stopped it if they wanted. The take that, oh, well, it's to justify the digital ID. And I find that interesting because that does tell you that it will be a right-wing kind of thing, where Farage is going to say, well, if we've got a digital IDs, we'll find out who these people are, and then we'll be able to deport them. And to be honest, you know, they might actually do a bit of that. I'm not going to be just endlessly pessimistic. They may actually implement the digital ID and get rid of hundreds of thousands of people. That's possible. But one of the things is that how that works, because if you've got Ahmed from Afghanistan and he's here illegally, he will not have access to services because he doesn't have a digital ID. So he isn't within the grid because he hasn't got his papers in order. He's here illegally. Therefore, by definition, he can't use goods and services. He'll find it difficult to get on a train or all these different things. When he's walking through a supermarket, it may be that the facial recognition thing kind of comes up with a little question mark. And it's like, well, we don't have a record. Like, who is he? Who are these people that we don't have a record of? So they will kind of light up on the system. But at the same time, you can turn that on its head as well. And you can say that if you are denied a digital ID, then you too will be outside of the system. You too won't be able to go on a train or access a bank account or pay for a bottle of milk in the supermarket or all of these different things, then you too will be outside of it like an illegal immigrant. Do you see what I mean? Where it relies on an in or out game, sort of board, if you like. So if you're on the inside...
Well, again, it reminds me of vaxxed and unvaxxed. Jacinda Ardern saying, it's a... what was it she said? Like a second-class citizen, something like that.
If it has the ability to make life difficult for an illegal immigrant, which I think it does, I think it will do that, then it also, by definition, can make your life difficult by reducing your access to things, which it can do. So this is what people have to consider. I remember when I did the video on it years ago, I used Soul Reaver, where it because it becomes this kind of you remember the PlayStation game Soul Reaver, which was like a proper head mash, where you could go in and out of realities, and it was like it was an amazing game because you didn't have levels, you were like this vampire, and you came back from the dead. And it was this like really grim, dark, gothic world. And I loved it. I loved how grim it all was. And but the game itself was just like one giant riddle or labyrinth, because you could only get so far, and then you would fight a boss and you'd get a new ability. Say you'd get claws. And then you'd discover that actually there's a certain kind of wall that you can climb up. And then it dawns on you that actually way back in the game, there was another wall like that now I can climb, and then you'd be able to go into water. And the world revealed itself as just one giant head mash, like one giant sort of riddle to be unlocked. And this is why I hate this gamified world of you've got to perform the task to proceed, perform the task, and then you get the magic sword or you get the new ability. And it's as if, and I've said it for years, I'm repeating myself, but it's as if this is now kind of imprinting itself across the world, across the country, if you like, onto us. When you bring Elon Musk's Starlink in, there isn't even any escape. I just find it a thoroughly depressant thing.
Yeah, it is. I'll play this short clip from a 1971 TV drama. It was about an authoritarian state in Britain, and it's a bunch of people, upper middle class people, discussing ID cards. Because I think it's quite interesting for perspective. Because just to show, here it is. And this is a program called The Guardians, incidentally, which I recommend to people.
Identity cards we've got already. And you're right. Most people don't mind them because what harm are they? And it's useful to be able to prove your identity and your blood group in case of an accident and a great deal more medical information, all of it, incidentally, stored away in computers. So, when the government decide that those who are genetically dangerous should be sterilized, the computers will already have the information.
That's appalling. Tim, it's wrong.
No, it should be done. It will be done.
It's logical.
Yes.
But every logical act will produce its own total of frustrated people, more and more of them. And with no outlet for their frustration in an election, of course. Because democracy isn't logical either.
No, it isn't. I think we both agree that democracies can be capable of more stupid idiots.
Oh, I agree. But then in a democracy, we can always change our bad masters. For worse ones. And my wife, when she's frustrated, which she frequently is, I don't mean sexually, of course, she breaks plates. And perhaps you should have a pile of plates on every street corner.
Perhaps we shall.
So, what I wanted to say about this is this stuff was being considered. The thing about that all the information is backed up on the central computer, and that it's handy, it's convenient, it's got all your information in one place. I find that amazing. When I saw that, I think in about 2012, and it reminded me that because these were the arguments used for the ID card back in 2004. But from today's perspective, it shows how basic that conception of it was, because actually today we've got all this high tech. I mean, it's not just that your medical information will be stored on this thing. It's that they'll know where you are 24/7, and they'll know every financial transaction that you ever make, and basically every choice that you ever make. I mean, well, yeah, anything that involves money, anything that that involves the state can surveil. So it's quite remarkable, really. So that was something I want to bring in.
One of the funny things about this and the AI is that it's going to require what people seem to be shocked at how much energy. I think already in America, the power they're using to power the AI data centers that they've got there now, and they plan on building hundreds more. But already now, it's consuming the energy of Texas. Just to sort of power these AI centers. And so you've got this problem because on the one hand, they've signed up to the green agenda where everything's going to run on windmills and tidal waves and all of this. But then it's if we do that, if we go all in on the green stuff, we can't do the AI surveillance stuff. And it's you go, oh, no, what do we want? Do we want kind of degrowth communism, make them eat the bugs, or should we go for digital tyranny? Should we have the surveillance state or gay-lental communism with solar power and they all freeze in the wind? I tell you what, folks, screw it. We're going to go for the surveillance state. I mean, I think they're even bringing back coal-fired power stations in some parts of America. This where Trump was my beautiful coal. We're going to have to have the digital gulag. And sorry, it's just too bad. Of course, it creates a massive incentive for power centers and nuclear power stations and all of this. They're going to make billions on that as well. But I just thought it was funny that they were left for a little bit in this dilemma. The AI surveillance facial recognition grid, it's really going to take a lot of energy to power it, which we hadn't considered. And it means, we go down the green route. We actually try to save the planet. And it's nah, fuck it. Surveillance grid it is. Let's go all in.
Yeah, there did seem to be that tussle between those two visions. And there was the WEF vision of, basically communism. Or this other one. But either way, it is tyranny. That's the thing. I mean, whether it's Musk's version where everything is surveilled and Palantir and all that, or it's the Klaus Schwab vision, It's still, I think it actually does amount, it amounts to the same thing. I mean, it's going to be everyone just watching endless porn. And, I mean, even Musk is up for a UBI. So how does it then differ really from the Klaus Schwab version? And I know he didn't explicitly advocate UBI, but it's all of one mind in the end. But anyway, I remain hopeful that this stuff will just fail one way or another. Okay, there was one other thing I wanted to ask you before we get to the super chats, and that is about this recent thing with Connor Tomlinson and Danny Finkelstein. That comes off the back of the Gaza war to some extent. I think all of this has been illuminated and enlivened by that. And it's what you see, and I know that you've seen this playing out on Twitter, is that Danny Finkelstein simply cannot justify his worldview, which is that Israel should exist for the Jews, for the Jewish people, and there are atheistic Jews, therefore it's ethnic, it's Ashkenazi, really. So they should have an ethnostate, but Britain is Britishness is defined in terms of values, and therefore Britain cannot be an ethno. English people, Scottish people cannot have an ethno state. And it's interesting because this has been brought to the fore, and the immediate conclusion to it is this is a contradiction. It's not fair. It doesn't make sense. It's ridiculous. Would you have anything to say about this?
Not really. I mean, this double standard is like old, isn't it? I mean, we used to discuss this back in the day. It's just that now it's highlighted much more than it used to be. It used to be, remember old Barbara Spector Lerner? You used to see that clip floating. I saw that again today. And there was this, and it was this kind of basic double standard that, yeah, they're hypocrites and they don't care. But the problem now is the hypocrisy and the double standard of like nationalism for me and not for thee, like that's not a particularly new thing. The new thing, the change, is that they're losing their kind of magic aura. Their magic defense shield is now just not hardly working at all. And I think you saw that with the Piers Morgan Fuentes thing. I think you see the manner that they've been mocking Finkelstein about me mum and me dad died in the holly and all of that. Like all of these kind of songs and memes. Just how widespread it is, this is the big change, rather than like, oh, look, they're kind of the hypocrites. That's nothing new. What's new is that what they call the boomer truth is beginning to evaporate. And this is why they're panicking, because what comes after that? What is the kind of the dispensation of all of these angry young white men when the old taboos no longer hold, when they just don't care, which they increasingly don't? And I haven't seen any kind of decent sort of response to that. Nothing to get your teeth into. I think it's boring. I do notice that there's some of them lean more and more like, say, Constantine Kissin. Would probably go so far as to say, well, the English people exist and they do deserve to stay the majority in their homeland. And they're being forced onto this kind of terrain, which they wouldn't. I mean, I've never heard him say that, by the way. But I would imagine he would say that. They're being forced in this direction. Otherwise, there's just going to be a break. Then they can at least say, well, yeah, of course the English people should have their own homeland. Some of them will. But really what this speaks to is the end of the post-war mythology, and it's, you know, it's
and meantime you've got the same thing happening across in America. I think Tucker Carlson sort of embodies this because he's trying to straddle both sides, but he's trying to maintain boomer truth but oppose wokery and oppose Israel to some extent. And I just don't think you can. I think that Tucker Carlson, even 3 months ago, he seemed very based and honest. But more recently, he's reverting to this bullshit about I'm not white. I don't want to be seen as white. Rejecting white identity politics, and which makes him a gatekeeper.
I cannot be bothered with all of this universalist bullshit, because we know where that leads. We're in now. The trouble that we're in is because of that. We've done it. We lived it. It's been rammed down our throats forever. And what happens is everybody else forms a group against your mass of individuals, and you get what has happened to us. Like, we've proven that if you're complaining about the status quo, you're complaining about the failure of that way of doing things and looking at the world.
Yeah, Yeah, you're complaining about what it has amounted to already, and therefore it's time for a new way of thinking. You see this breaking through with Nick Fuentes. And, you know, we've all got criticisms to make of Nick Fuentes, but I think you have to hand it to him. He's smashed through a massive taboo, even with all the deplatforming that he's been subjected to. I think it's an incredible achievement. And the effects that it's going to have on the discourse, I mean, I don't think he's going to go away. And I even think this year has been a real roller coaster in terms of the discourse and constant change, constant evolution, almost by the month. And I think that I think that next year is going to be the same. I think that this time next year we're going to be struggling to keep up with all the changes, all the new ideas that are and the slaying of old ideas. As the boomers go, their worldview is dying in real time with them.
Yeah, yeah. And the British state is downstream from a lot of these events, like we saw today where, you know, one woman from Britain has been blocked from entering America, and then a lot of the Eurocrats have been blocked. And I think there's going to be more of that. I think they're being kicked into touch. Again, everybody just wants something to get lost. There's a whole class of these people who've been catastrophic for Britain, America, Europe. It's been a disaster, and everybody just wants them to go away and stop acting so high and mighty when all you've done is bring retardation and misery and violence and this squalid shit to our homes, our homelands. They just go, for God's sake.
Yeah. And the smugness, like, again, to bring us back to Hope Not Hate, the assumption that they had that they were right, that easy confidence that they used to have, I think if it hasn't evaporated by now, it fucking well should have. And as you said, I wouldn't want to be those people in the near future, because I think unless they change their tune, they are going to be public enemies in a way that you and I actually aren't and never have been.
Yeah, and this is a funny thing. Let's try and end on a lighter note. Here's the thing with the funny thing about digital ID and all of that is that it seems to me like the people who are bringing that in assume that they're going to be in power forever, because I can tell you, like, because I've got a right to be paranoid about a digital ID because I've got NGOs and quangos hunting me down. But then that can flip. What happens when our guys who are, I might moan about reform, but our guys, reformers filter the gills with our lads. I'll say that. I know for a fact that the lower ranks of reform are crammed with people who follow me on Twitter. And you're looking at a situation then when these are the people who are bringing in the digital ID. I'll be fine, by the way. But then if you have been part of the managerialist system, this quangocracy that have inflicted this misery on people, maybe your future's not looking too bright. Maybe people are going to find out who you are with the very sort of surveillance state that you're bringing in. Maybe people in these anti-hate groups, maybe the people who've been hounding us forever are going to find that actually it's them who are now having their faces scanned by facial recognition technology. And it's them who are now going to be monitored about their attitudes to things. I'm just saying, if that's what you want, if you want to have a surveillance state, there's going to be a fight over who controls it. And I'd rather have our people controlling it than them. And the way things are looking, it could very well be ours. So, Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Okay, we'll get to the super chats now. There aren't that many. Certainly nowhere near as last year. That was incredible last year on your stream. Mr. Cholley says, for the non-British listeners, could you elaborate on the whole UK thing and the reaction to it? Well, we outlined it earlier. It was created. There was a Twitter account created by, I can't remember the guy's name now, Duke Drukpa or something.
Crumbler. I get that name. I find that difficult name as well. Crumbler Gruptvi or whatever.
Yeah, but, and he's created a Twitter account called Mytho UK with a hyphen. So that's I think it's got a hyphen. So that's where to find it. But yeah, you go more.
Well, what it is really, and you can get kind of theories all about this, but what it is examples of the British Isles being deterritorialized. And so you'll have, for example, it'll be a woman in the Welsh Valleys with like holding a little basket of leeks. But she'll be wearing, but it'll be like, you know, a Pakistani woman, and she'll be wearing a hijab, and it's this kind of oddness. It's the uncanny valley of what the Britain has become, and you'll have, for example, sometimes it's just straightforward. You'll have like a bunch of youth for urban London youth with their pants falling down. And then behind them, there'll be like this sort of statue of the glory days of the empire or this kind of thing. So the general aesthetic is of the Britain being terraformed by something else. And there was an interesting thing where it was in the New Statesman, and they cottoned onto this. And I listened to their podcast or whatever. And they were like trying to get to grips with it, because if you have, for example, a picture of just a Muslim man walking down the street with his wife, but the street is falling apart, the houses are boarded up, everything just looks degraded and run down, and then there'll be a red phone box, like the old-fashioned phone boxes. And so then again, you've got this startling kind of juxtaposition of things. And in the New Statesman article, they were talking about this, because what's funny about it is that the UK aesthetics account, he would never write anything. He would just post the pictures, and that's it. And everybody gets it on a gut level. Like, so it speaks to your intuition that you're not being told what to think about this, but everybody automatically does think negatively about it and find it kind of eerie and offsetting. But these libtards at the New Statesman were getting to grips with this, and the problem they had was precisely that. Because it was just, according to their normal worldview, well, it was just a Muslim woman standing there with leeks in the Welsh Valley. It was just a couple of black lads walking past a telephone box. Or it was just, like, what's wrong with that? They've done this for years. You know, it's worse, you know, this is the meme again. They've been doing this for years. But now what's happened is, say, our side of this are now using this kind of the language of signs and symbols, and we get it. And what's more, all of the public get it as well. So now it's as if the lefties are the only ones who don't get it. They are now on the outside of that. And they had to kind of cope and kind of theory sell their way to, well, it's the context that people are bringing to the photo and all of this kind of thing. When it was like this long, long way to say people immediately despise the country that our values have created, because that's what it boils down to. UK is deeply dystopian, but at the same time, in that, there's something subversive about it, which kind of leans in to the what I think is, despite the doom and gloom, is a surging sort of right-wing backlash, but it's much more kind of realist and gritty than what was in 2016.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, the guy's name is pronounced Kangli Drukpa. Yeah, it's basically an observation of the way things are, and therefore the commissars simply don't like it, and they have to find some way to neuter it by pretending that it's misleading, it's biased, it's not, it's ill-intentioned. No, it's just literally, I mean, that Twitter account literally just shows photos of things. It's one photo after another. And yeah, there are commonalities between all these photos, but it's not by a biased sample. This is what ordinary people are seeing in their towns every fucking day now.
Yeah, it's funny because it's like, remember that woman where she couldn't accept like that there were genetic differences, because it's again like here is it's a photo of two black women walking through a scenic village in the Yorkshire Dales. That's like this UK thing. So on the face of it, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's the same way as well. There is genetic differences. And that's just a fact. That's here it is. We're just presenting you what is an empirical truth in the same way that here is. And in both cases, they have to add things on. They have to infer. And they would have to like write a 5,000 word essay about why the person presenting the photo is actually racist. Because then the onus is on them to say what racism they've detected. So it just gets this really complicated sort of, they then have to infer the motives of the person who just took a photo and explain why it's racist. But if that's the case, yeah, how do they know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
How do they know? If it's just a black woman walking down the Yorkshire Dales, then how do you know? Well, how can you infer that? It's very funny.
It is. It sort of catches them out. So the UK thing, I think, has been very interesting this year. And I wrote I think it was the essay was called Grilling and the UK Inferno. And people can read about it there. But yeah, you can just go and find it yourself. Mr. Cholley also said, Morgoth did a show on Till Death Do Us Part, and Devin Stack did the US version, All in the Family. Would you two do a joint show on the two programs? I mentioned this to Devin, and he liked the idea. How do we make this happen? P.S. Many Americans watched British TV shows growing up as it was shown on public television. I think that was PBS. He's suggesting that you and Devin Blackpilled do a stream together on those two programs together.
I've never done anything on Till Death Do Us Part.
I didn't recognize that.
I did something on Whatever Happened to the Likely Lads as a video essay that I did some years ago. I've never done anything on Till Death Do Us. But I certainly understand why Blackpilled is looking at that. Yeah,
yeah, definitely. And I got those DVDs two years ago now, because I was thinking about writing about British comedy and the history of TV comedy for the last 50 years. So I got those DVDs, got them all cheap secondhand. I haven't watched them yet. And I dealt Till Death Do Us Part. I'll leave that for the future. I'll talk about that. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I think it's shitty and rotten. Rising Damp is an infinitely better program than that. I'll leave that for now. Arklo Rocks said, all right, men, just a quick word of thanks for your two voices of utter sanity that I've been profoundly grateful to be able to listen to every Christmas for the last 6 years. Thank you very much for being generous enough to share your thoughts and views. Well, thank you very much, Arklo Rocks. I think it's a pleasure and a privilege for both Morgoth and me. Isn't that right, Morgoth?
Yep, thank you very much.
All right. Soaker City. I'm in my early mid-40s, and oddly enough, I put the peak year of the before times at 1997 as well. Worth a deeper examination. On the bright side, at least, we begin the new year with a justified fight that we are winning. Merry Christmas. Well, thank you very much, Soaker City. And I think that point is well made, that as much as the situation is grim and depressing, we do seem to be winning, relentlessly, in fact.
I'd like to say, thanks to Soaker City and thanks for the support over the years. But what you are saying there, I think part of it is precisely there is a kind of doggedness doom pill about the progress that's being made now. It isn't as joyous when we thought we were winning in 2016 and stuff, but we weren't really. There's a kind of it is the fact that we're just kind of blackpilled to death. And there's this kind of hard realism now, and sort of seriousness, which I find it fascinating. To be honest, I think there isn't any this kind of fake confidence anymore. It's just this slog, you know.
Yeah, we're battle hardened at this stage. I mean, I think we're all more careful nowadays. I think we understand much more about how power actually works nowadays than back then we didn't. Back then, I think we still had a democratic idea that we, someone else said this a few nights ago, a millennial, that we just needed to voice our complaints and speak the truth and that would win the day. We're not that naive nowadays. We understand that it's about power. Chief Noticer said, thoroughly enjoying the millennial this year. Thank you, Woz. Has Morgoth had any contact from Granville Thorndyke in recent years? I can't help but think of the content we're missing out on not having him around, to my knowledge. Cheers, both of you. So, Granville Thorndyke?
No, I haven't. That's a damn shame, because that was, he did five or six of the best sort of videos ever and then disappeared. I think he was Irish, but yeah, he disappeared off. Unless he popped up under a different name somewhere, but as far as I know, he just disappeared off into the ether.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember if he appeared on Millennial. I think he might have in 2016. Yeah, he did in 2016. And crewbot.net said, most super of all chats. Thank you very much. Dardy said, epic white pill to end the stream. Have a bottle of whiskey or maybe wine on me. Merry Christmas to you both. And he made a very generous super chat. Well, thank you very much. I don't have wine, but I will have a glass bottle of Coca-Cola after this. Aus Drew said, thank you, Morgoth, for all your work this year. And a big thanks to Woz. Merry Christmas. Thank you, Aus Drew. And Christmas to you. Pleb Lordy. Could we use the work of Fanon et al. To paint the left as servants of capital and colonialism? Why use neutral words like remigration and multiculturalism when we could be saying decolonization?
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't go in for that, to be honest. I don't really get sort of autistic about, oh, we have to use this word or that word. Like, there's a new buzzword and everybody's got to jump on board with it. It's like, yeah, okay, if it enters me lexicon, that's fine. But I think you've just got to keep chipping away at this kind of thing. What you don't want is like some new phrase which you're going to have to explain to everybody. So remigration is like, everybody gets that immediately. And it's been picked up. And if you're going to have like decolonization, I don't know, it's what the kids call coded. So that's sort of that's woke coded. I do understand though, because from their theory, we are being colonized and capital is doing it. I do take the point.
Yeah, it's a clever point. I just wonder if in real life they would fall for it. I don't know if they would. Rich said, splendid conversation, lads. Thanks for all you both do. Since November, all company directors have to have a digital ID. Slowly, it's creeping in. Well, yes, as we were saying earlier, it's ominous. Cronus, last report, said, I made a generous super chat. Thank you very much. And he said, thank you for everything you do for us. Long time watcher. Helps to get through a very bad time. Morgoth, I'm glad to have been of help. Morgoth, you're like a priest from Dune speaking to us from the future and narrating our collective insane past. Always loved your science fiction takes. You two have a great new year. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm tempted to sort of get into the Dune sort of sci-fi take, but hopefully this time next year I might have a book out, but we'll see.
Okay.
Well, I do love the fantasy sci-fi sort of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So do we both do. I loved your tweet where you likened Serco to OCP from RoboCop. I thought that was brilliant. They fund the every aspect of this. That was great.
Yeah, it's horrible. This is what I'll say as well. I think it is grim times, but it's to do with, like, say, that UK aesthetics thing as well. Like, there's something interesting that we've got going on, because if it was a healthy era, you would have a kind of intellectual movement that would be attracting people, and usually it would be on the left. If you think of, like, say, the Maynard strikes in the 80s or something, it spawns its own discussion. But in our time, there's no honest discussion to be had in the mainstream, which is really going to sort of get people thinking. For the UK aesthetics thing, for example, that's a kind of cultural moment in a way. And that should be discussed on... Once upon a time, that would have been discussed on, say, BBC Two. They had this really pretentious show after Newsnight, and this kind of thing. But it's not, because they're so insecure and fragile. All they can do is kind of, like, scare you and make your life a misery, and never. But intellectually, they're just cowards. Conformist cowards. The UK aesthetic, for example, it's something that could be discussed on Have I Got News For You, and they could laugh at it, and they could kind of dig into it a little bit, but they can't, because they're intellectual cowards, and the whole system is. So it falls to us to do these kinds of things and to explore culture and the cultural moment as best we can.
Yeah, and this is something I find endlessly fascinating, the fact that the mainstream just doesn't talk about life as it actually is today. I've talked before about the moral maze. I'll say it one more time. It was as if they were in 2010 or 2005 when they were talking about the subject that they were talking about. And it was remarkable. And I see this all the time in TV dramas, the same. They're not addressing today's actual culture. It's like a Potemkin village thing, or a Groundhog Day thing. It's really quite striking when you realize it. Okay, Pleblordy, what is this debate you're talking about with the woman who denies genetic differences? I'd like to watch it. It was I played it earlier in this show, and you can find it on Twitter and on Instagram. The name is something like Anna Moore. She's a Latina woman, Latina lesbian. You can find it easily. All right, Stick sent me here. Says, there was a really good dystopian video about the future of digital ID in the UK. It may have been made by Morgoth. Came out around COVID. I can't find it anywhere now. I think I might remember vaguely the one you're talking about. It was sort of animation, and it went through someone's day. Again, all of this stuff is very much connected with COVID in my mind, because that's when it really emerged. There were hints of it before then, but it really came to the fore then.
That was, I posted that. That was some Richard Rich or something. Rich something. And he did a video which was an animation, but it was about digital currency. That's what I think he's getting at. But I didn't actually.
Yeah, I remember that you shared it, and that's how it got traction. I think that's correct. I think that's the one that we're all remembering. Okay, and then finally, Justin Foster says, do you think it's possible that recent migrants are being set up to be the fall guys for a coming financial collapse? Seems that way in the US with the massive Somali frauds. They don't seem sophisticated enough to do it on their own. I don't, actually. I mean, how are you going to blame them? What are you going to do? You're going to put them up in court and say, you corrupted our society? No. I think it's happening for various reasons, most of them ideological and, well, ethnocidal. I think they're trying to kill off white countries. That's why I think they're here. And they want to encourage maximum race mixing. That's what I think. Although a guest that I had on last night, Dogmatic Slumbers, thinks that all of that is slowly changing now and they're going in the opposite direction. But yeah. So, Morgoth, do you think that all this recent migration is to cover for a financial collapse?
No, I think it's the opposite. I think it's to stave it off. If your model is one of infinite growth, and you've got a low replacement birth rate, they need to just cram in the bodies. They need more bodies. And they're to write the books. Otherwise, the bond markets will tank and people will lose their pensions and all of this sort of thing. So I think people who advocate for remigration have to take this on board. You have to accept that we would enter a kind of financial black hole. If you are going to remove millions of people under 30, yeah, it's likely you're going to have a massive recession. Because people will say, well, they take all of this money out of the system, but that's fair enough. But the problem is, it's kind of a big Ponzi scheme. And they need this endless supply of bodies to keep it all rolling over, to keep the scam going. My view of this is that we're going to have to just prepare for hard times. I said this to Tom Harwood, is it, on the other day, where he's always like, we need more houses, and we can have some curbs on immigration, but we can't have like a degrowth thing. And I'm at the situation where I'm like, let the economy burn. Let it all. I'm sorry, but we have to get off this treadmill. And if you have to think of it where we're going to take a time out. We need our country back. We need to sort ourselves out. We need to feel good in our skin again. We've been through something here which isn't right. We need to up the birth rates. We need to just have a long time out. And it may be where we're eating corned beef and potatoes again, but like we were, like, what, in the 70s and 80s? It's this idea that endless growth, endless line go up, endless new goodies, and it's killing us. It's absolutely killing us. We need an off-ramp from this neoliberal system. And it may well be that things have to be simple a bit. But I'll tell you one thing, there'd be houses galore. Once the nasty business was out of the road, everybody would have a house. So you begin to kind of rejuvenate yourselves. If you think things instead of like this wiggish linear line, if you think of things in cycles, you think, well, okay, we need to at least get into winter proper before we can begin to enjoy the spring again. But when you like sort of view it as just a line going up forever, it's just exhausting. It's killing us.
Oh yeah, it's exhausting, but it's also just soulless. I mean, we can see what it's doing. And I know that we shouldn't behave as if this is innocently happening. But from the point of view of a certain echelon and the general public, you know, this is the justification that we've got to do this in order to have to more growth and to keep our standard of living rising and so on. Well, I don't think it's done us any favors. I mean, I can vaguely remember life in the 80s and it was fine. I mean, I was a kid, but, you know, no one else. I mean, people didn't seem miserable. It was fine. So if we have to go back to that standard, and, you know, bear in mind, we would still have modern technology. But if we have to go back to that standard of living, really, it's not a big deal. It would be so much better to, you know, if you rent a house and it's not spick and span, it doesn't have the latest technology, but it's very affordable. Well, that would be fucking great. Rather than this ridiculous standard for everything that we now expect nowadays. I think a simpler life would be better for really everyone. I just hope that we would also be able to ban OnlyFans, for example, and maybe even Instagram, because I think in order to raise the birth rates, that would certainly be necessary. That kind of thing would just have to go. Anyway, okay, well, that seems to be all the super chats. So let's call it a day there. Morgoth is on a different schedule this year, so we're not going to have the mega stream. Yeah. I made that clear to everyone in advance. I hope that this has been uplifting for people in spite of the subject matter. Morgoth, why don't we end on some well wishes for everyone's Christmas tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, maybe next year I can come back and do the mega one. There was somebody, I've hesitated to say this because somebody replied to me on Twitter, hopefully that you won't be able to see now, because I thought it was quite a thing. And he said, this is the highlight of my he says I'm on my own, and this is pretty much, it sounds sad, but this is pretty much the highlight of my Christmas. And I was like, and I just replied and I said, like, hang in there, mate. And look, I understand that there is probably going to be people who are out there now kind of lonely on Christmas Eve. So I'd like to wish them who are out there a Merry Christmas, and hang in there, and we'll see you all in the new year. And thanks for everybody else for tuning in. Maybe we can do the big mega one next year. But yeah, that played on my mind that there's some lonely souls out there, and you know, you're not entirely forgotten. Christmas is a bad time for people, some people who are left in difficult positions, and I understand it. So you're not alone. Merry Christmas.
Yeah. I would echo those sentiments. Ethno-Nationalist has just sent a super chat saying, great stream, Mose and Morgoth. Thank you. You know, I'm not going to be with family tomorrow, and I regret that. And I think all of us, well, many of us are in a similar position. I'll be doing things that make me happy, that are in keeping with this time of year. I'll be probably watching some Christmas films. And I would suggest that other people do the same thing if they're going to be alone. But bear in mind that you're not going to be alone, because we're all, you know, there are other people doing the same thing. Of course, I'll be doing the Christmas Day AMA tomorrow night. But it can't all be about this and millennial. Christmas is a special time, and try to celebrate it in your own way. Try to enjoy it. Don't let it drain your morale. That's not what is supposed to happen. If that's happening, then something is wrong. And just try to remember that you're not alone. There are always other people, even if they're not there with you at the time. Yeah, so we will do what we can. All right. Okay, well, let's end it there. Morgoth, thank you very much for this stream. And everyone else, thank you for watching. Thank you for commenting and super chatting. I hope you're enjoying Millennial, and I hope you have a lovely Christmas tomorrow. And I will see you tomorrow night.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks. Okay, Morgoth, thanks for appearing on Millennial 2025. I will see everyone else tomorrow. Merry Christmas, everyone.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host?
T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.